for the zone session.
Please remain seated or be seated.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. First thing I'd like to talk about this afternoon is the political work that was done. It's this incessant campaign work that was done in the Tasker Street office and elsewhere. Remember, John Safrisi, another one of those no-work board members from Citizens Alliance, was the cousin of Roseanne Pacello. And when we asked him about Ms. Pacello, he referred to the Senate office on Tasker Street as the ward headquarters, meaning the headquarters of the local Democratic Committee ward. It was a really stunning statement because, of course, it is a state office. They did do state business there for the Senate. But that's not what Mr. Safrisi saw. What he saw were all the campaigns and all the meetings and all the activities that went on, much of it run by his cousin, Ms. Pacello, the ward leader. Now, Mr. Safrisi is not an unintelligent man. He's a high school teacher at Roman Catholic High School. He didn't even know that his cousin, Roseanne Pacello, was an employee of the Senate. He thought that she was the ward leader. And that tells you an awful lot about what was going on at Tasker Street on a regular basis. You heard it from witness after witness for all of these many, many campaigns that they handled, both for Mr. Fumo and others. They always said it was all hands on deck. Marone used that phrase. So did Mr. Coyne, Mr. Fonseca, Mr. Snyder, every time they were talking about a campaign, because that's how this operation was set up. They had these people down there ready to jump. Arnao, Pacello, Novelli, Spagna, this is what they did. And this is what they were paid with state dollars to do. They had meetings in this office all day long, not in separate space, but in space that was paid for by the Senate of Pennsylvania, as we'll talk about later. They were not volunteers, as Mr. Fumo tried to suggest to you. In fact, a number of the witnesses told you quite honestly, including Mr. Coyne and Mr. Wilson, they didn't care who won. They were just doing their jobs. You remember Dan Coyne, he was an important witness because he worked on many campaigns, he told you, but the most he got involved was on the Casey campaign. Vince Fumo wanted Bob Casey to be elected governor of Pennsylvania in 2002, and he threw his whole operation into that campaign. Marone told you that he spent half his time in the months leading up to it working on that campaign. You remember he even slipped when he was in the hospital and they wrote a story about him working in the hospital. And you have that article in evidence where he said, I'm working on the Casey campaign. And Gary Tuma, the press secretary, called him up and said, you can't say that. You know, you can't tell what you're doing, that you're a state employee working on the Casey campaign. Dan Coyne gave a huge effort. He was the computer support person. And as he told you, it was a ton of work. He said as much as 20 hours a week, particularly as the primary came up. You had 20 staff people in Harrisburg working on the Casey campaign, and this was not Tasker Street. These were people working 24/7 on a campaign, racing down to the wire, and he was their one support person. And he told you Senator Fumo put him on that job. He got no additional money he got nothing from the Casey campaign, nothing from any political committee. He did this because he was told to do it as part of his Senate job. And he told you that he just adamantly refused to acknowledge, whatever the defense tried, that he also put in 37 and a half hours a week for the Senate, because he didn't. In fact, he was going to law school at night, and so he couldn't. This was part of what he did during the day. And he very candidly told you that and candidly told you how badly he now feels about it. You saw exhibit after exhibit regarding the political campaigning that was going on. Just one is Exhibit 988. I won't go through all of them, but this one's really interesting because it also gets you into the mindset. This is during the 2002 race. And what's happening here is Senator Fumo is working with John Hawkins, one of his Senate staff people you didn't hear a lot about, to place ads against Ed Rendell in the primary that's coming up. And they're deceptive ads. They're ads that say they're being paid for something I think called public officials for a better Pennsylvania. And what the ads are is they're anti-Philadelphia ads. You have this Philadelphia senator using his Philadelphia staff to run ads in other part of the state against Ed Rendell, saying things like, you don't want a mayor of Philadelphia as your governor, do you? So they're playing on this anti-Philadelphia sentiment in other parts of the state by using a different name for the committee. In fact, if you look in Jamie Spagna's Quicken records, I won't show you now, but you'll find it. You'll find the $35,000 that Fumo for Senate gave to this new PAC called Public Officials for a Better Pennsylvania so they could conceal what was going on. this is the melange of things that's happening, using state employees, state resources, state time to run a campaign and to do it in this fashion. Dan Coyne told you that he was 22 years old when this was going on. When he was first hired by Mr. Fumo. And he's still a relatively young man. And that also illustrates a lot of what happened here. Mr. Fumo got young people who didn't know the rules. He knew the rules perfectly well. But he put these people like Spagna, who was, I think, 16 years old when she started in his office, and Novelli and Coyne and Phil Press, who you saw and we'll talk about a bit later, put them together with these old reliables who've committed to the program long before, Cozzo and Pacello and Arneo. And that's how you get this team that's working for Senator Fumo's personal and political interests on Tasker Street. And one other really interesting thing about Coyne before I move on, and it's true of a number of the other people, notice that these people, many of them have left, pretty much all have left Senate employment by now, some at different times. Coyne left in 2005. Gina Novelli left way back in 2002. Jamie Spagna more recently. None of them went back and did anything for Senator Fumo afterwards. Isn't that interesting? You heard how we're all a family. They volunteer. They want to do this. None of them. Dan Coyne hasn't worked on another campaign on his, quote, free time. Gina Novelli, who was about as hostile a witness as we could call, if you'll recall, and I'll talk more about her. She left in 2002. She hasn't been back. Jerry Sable, remember, he told you how much he loved working on the farm. This was so interesting. He left right in the middle in 2003. He retired while it was still being put together. Has never set foot on that farm again. Use your common sense. What is happening here? These people didn't do these things because they were volunteers. They didn't do it because they loved it. They did it because it was their jobs. And they tried to do it as well as they did the rest of their jobs, because this is what they were told to do. And then when the job was over, the job was over. Jamie Spagna kept writing all of his personal checks and personal bills on the Senate job, on Senate time, until she left in January of 2008, more than a year ago. And then she told you what she did. She put it all on a desk, she handed it to Roseanne Pacello, and left. She's not writing his checks today. Why is that? If she was a volunteer and they all love and admire him and want to do this on their free time. What it tells you, ladies and gentlemen, is we're being taken for a ride. Now, I want to say one thing before I move on. I'm going to talk quite a bit about Jamie Spagna, because I think she's a very important witness. But speaking of Senator Fumo's testimony reminds me of one thing I want to say, because throughout the closing statement, I'm going to keep referring to his testimony, because that is what we're weighing the evidence against. There are so many points on which you have a huge number of witnesses who say one thing, and then he alone says the opposite. And I will tell you, and I don't say this with any gladness at all, he was not honest with you. You may know it already, but I'm going to point out numerous times in which he made false statements to you and show you where they are. And I don't say that with any glee. It's the way it is, and it's something that we have to address as we go through the closing argument. But that raises a very important point that I want to make sure that I'm clear on, and that is that the government has the burden of proof in this case. That's what Judge Buckwalter has told you, and I know that's the law that you're going to apply. The burden never shifts. Senator Fumo did not have to take the witness stand. He has a right to remain silent. He could have remained silent, and still you could find him not guilty and should find him not guilty if you conclude that the government has not proven its case beyond a reasonable doubt. We always have the burden. We accept that, and as I'm telling you now, for hours on end, we have met that. But I want to make it very clear when I talk about his testimony. The judge is going to give you one more instruction, I know, at the end of the case, which is important, which is that a defendant does not have to testify. But if a defendant does, you may consider his testimony in the same way that you consider any other evidence. And that's the light in which I'm commenting on it. You can consider it the same way you do anything else you've heard in this trial. Do I believe it? Does it make sense? Does it fit with the other evidence? Is there other evidence I would expect to hear if that were true, what he told me? Are there other people I would expect to hear from? You can consider all that, and that's the light in which I'm presenting it, while reminding you that it's our burden of proof. It does not shift, and at the end of the day, that's the question that you have to answer. And you'll notice I'm not going to comment in any way on that with respect to Ruth Arneo. She exercised her right not to testify. That is her right, and you will be instructed not to draw any conclusion from that, and I know you won't. That's what our Constitution requires. So with that clear, let's talk about the ways in which his testimony does not match up with any of the others. And the first topic I'm going to get into involves Jamie Spagna, and she is a very, very important witness in this case. In fact, the fraud on the Senate can pretty much be decided based on her circumstances alone. If we take a look at Government Exhibit 26, this is a very important document. This is the memo that Ruth Arnao writes to Gina Novelli and Jamie Spagna in 2002 about how they're going to divide their jobs. And everything on this chart, this list of what they're going to do, is not work for the Senate. There is not one item here that relates to Senate work. It's all the personal bills and the political bills and the CSRS campaign filings and Citizens Alliance and that I will talk about. This is a smoking gun document. This tells you exactly what's happening in this office. The people, employees have been put there to do personal and political work. Our work day is from 9 to 5 with exception to election time. I'll only ask for time for you guys when absolutely needed. It covers the lunch hour, the vacation sheets. This is the guide for their work. And says, I will work with both of you. I want us all to be a team. This is very important to me. Between the three of us, we do most of the very important work in this office. That's absolutely right. That's how they looked at it. The most important work in Fumo world, as I said, was taking care of Mr. Fumo. And that is what the job was. In fact, this job originally belonged to Ruth Arnao. This is the job she had in the late 90s. When you look at the Quicken records, she's the one who started those Quicken accounts, as you heard. Gina Novelli came on as her assistant, and then they got Jamie Spagna as an assistant. Ms. Novelli left in 2002, and this is what Ms. Spagna did throughout 2002 and 2003. Let's take a look at Exhibit 1599. We're going to get back to this and probably look at it in more detail if we have time when we get to the obstruction of justice case, but I want to focus you right now on the first paragraph here. We're jumping ahead now to 2005. When the investigation is underway, everything's been deleted or wiped, it's going to be deleted. The search has taken place on Tasker Street. And if we blow up this first part here, Luchko has told Mr. Fumo that he has Senator Fumo's backup cards. And doesn't say anything about Jamie, but Senator Fumo responds and says, go get all of my backups and give them to Roe and also give her Jamie's PC card. I will keep them with me. Do not destroy anything. Now, the defense has highlighted this as evidence that Senator Fumo does not want to destroy anything. It's exactly the opposite, and I'll go through it with you when we get to the obstruction case. What he wants to do is the same thing he did with his PC card. He wants to be the one to control what exists and that he wants to keep. It's the same reason he gave an instruction to everybody, don't delete your email to or from me, while keeping 20,000 emails on his PC card. He's the one who wants to be in control and decide whether things are going to be turned over or not. And that's what's happening here. But here's the interesting part. He asked for Jamie's PC card because to him, in his world, that is one important PC card. That has all of the Quicken files and all of the political files regarding all of the campaigns, all of his personal accounts, political accounts, going back at this point 8 years. Nobody wants to lose that or any backup of it. This PC card that he asked for, don't destroy anything, the government never gets. It's under subpoena, but he takes it because he wants to make sure he has control of it. And it is never produced to the government, even though it's under subpoena. Where is it? Who knows? But what do we have? As I said at the outset this morning, we get lucky. We do a search of Mr. Luchko's house in October of 2005, about 5 months after this, and find an old PC card. The old PC card that we find from Jamie has the Quicken records through 2003 and the political files, the word files, up through the campaign in 2004 in the spring when Mr. Fumo runs for re-election. As I said before, a stroke of bad luck turns into amazing luck because if you wanted to know what was in Jamie Spagna's computer as it's relevant to this case, you couldn't pick a better time. She told you her job changed in 2004. You know everything in the Fumo office changed in 2004 as they scrambled to change all of their practices, knowing that they were under investigation. And Jamie was part of that. She started to go to meetings with the senator. She started to take on some constituent duties, and she was very honest in telling you all that. we want to see what is the snapshot of what her computer looked like before that change happened. And we got it, and we got lucky. And what it is this box that's sitting on the floor next to me, which is Government Exhibit 79. This is a printout of the contents of Jamie Spagnon's computer, 1,400-plus pages long when you print it out. It's actually not all the contents, because the Quicken records we printed out separately, and those are marked as separate exhibits, exhibits 80, ABCD, et cetera. We printed all that out, but we took the Word files and the Excel files, and it's all here. And it is fascinating, and it's exactly what an investigator would want to see. And what we see is there is not one page that refers to work of the Senate, not one. There is nothing about a constituent. There is nothing about a piece of legislation, nothing. What you have in here, and Mr. Sendek on the screen can just scroll through some of it, is one fundraising letter after contributor chart, after demand letter, after another, for political campaign after political campaign, for page after page after page. This was her job, exactly as Exhibit 26, that memo from Ms. Arnao, said would be her job. Now, when Gina Novelli testified, it was kind of interesting. You saw she had the job before Ms. Spagnon, a very hostile witness. She couldn't, when Mr. Pease was asking her questions, she couldn't remember anything. She couldn't remember the computer she worked on. She couldn't remember doing the DiCicco account, which I haven't even talked about yet, that they're doing the political account for somebody who's not even in the office, but the friendly city councilman. On cross-examination, she became very friendly. She answered yes to whatever leading question she was asked. And she was asked the leading question, well, all of this on Exhibit 26, if we go back to that, Mark, everything on Exhibit 26, they said, well, that would just take you 2 hours, right? 2 hours a week. And she said, yeah, because she would say yes to whatever they asked. And I think she was asked the question, this doesn't describe everything you did for the Senate, does it? And she said, oh, no. And the question was, you did lots of Senate things besides that. And she said, oh, yes, without ever identifying a one. Mr. Jacobs told you in his opening statement, he said that there are rational explanations and there are reasonable explanations. And it's a helpful guide because, as we've heard, the government has to prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt. Government doesn't have to prove its case beyond all doubt. If you have a doubt based on reason and common sense, you must acquit. But if you have any radical thing that you can think of, then that is not probably a reasonable doubt. The problem that Mr. Jacobs has is that, of course, it's backwards. He says we're the ones with the radical explanations. Well, look at this. You've got a memo that says, here are your duties. Gina do this. Jamie do that. Our workday is 9 to 5. Take an hour for lunch. This is how much vacation you have. And the radical explanation is, this explains 2 hours of the week. Oh, and by the way, there's another 35.5 hours that we're not talking about. I mean, please. This memo obviously is comprehensive and obviously describes exactly what they did. And if you didn't know that, you just have to go through the box and go through the Quicken records and listen to the testimony. Jamie Spagna was a wonderful witness. She, and I can't say this for everybody who testified, but she had no axe to grind. It was very clear that she is still friends with Mr. Fumo and Ms. Arnao. She didn't want to be here, but she's an honest young lady, and she took the stand. And she testified and told the story. Our direct examination of her lasted more than a day. And she told you exactly what you see here. This is my job. This is what I did. I did the personal accounts. I did the political accounts. And I worked on the accounts regarding Citizens Alliance. If we look at Exhibit 913, 914, these are the lists of accounts that she, along with others, handled. You have more than a dozen accounts of Senator Fumo and his various investments. Citizens Alliance itself had more than 20 accounts. This could be done in an hour a week or 2 hours a week. I mean, this is ridiculous. If you think of your own life, of course, if you have to write checks once a week or whenever you do your bills, sure, sometimes it takes 10 minutes. Sometimes it might take a bit longer. If you have a family, if you have kids, if you own a house, you take on more responsibilities, it's going to take longer. There'll be weeks when it takes maybe a few hours. But what if you owned a farm? What if you owned rental units where you had 15 tenants? What if you owned condominiums? What if you owned three other houses besides the mansion that you live in on Green Street? What if you don't pay for most of your meals, and you need someone to get your reimbursements from the Dilworth Law Firm and the bank and the Senate? What if you maintain an elaborate Christmas list that you want to be distributed to people? And what if you had any number of other investments? The financial disclosure form that is required to be filed, if we go to page 30, this is Exhibit 1009, goes on for pages with the different partnerships and different investments that Senator Fumo had, all of it controlled out of Tasker Street. What if you were the chairman of a bank? What if you earned close to $1 million from a law firm? What if you ran your own campaign committee and several other PACs with all of the elaborate legal requirements for political reporting that come with it, where you're earning hundreds of thousands of dollars or raising hundreds of thousands of dollars? In fact, Mr. Fumo told us he was the leading state legislator in the country in terms of fundraising, and you need to handle that, and you need to report on it, and you need to comply with all the federal, state, and local laws. What if you had all that? Is that a full-time job? Well, it turns out it's more than a full-time job, because Jamie Spagna couldn't handle all of this on her own. That's why Marianne Cortullo had four or five of these accounts that she handled. I mean, the logic here is very obvious. They hired somebody, put her in the basement at Tasker Street to do this. First it was Ruth Arnao, then it was Gina Novelli, and then it was Jamie Spagna. Very interesting, when Mr. Fumo testified, and he was on direct examination for more than a day, he was not asked one question about Jamie Spagna. And the only thing that he said on cross-examination was when he was discussing where she did the work, and he said, oh, maybe I should have had her go to the second floor. He talked about where she did the work, but not what she did. And what she did is this. She not only didn't put in 37 and a half hours a week for the Senate, she put in 0 hours for the Senate. The point here is that it's not that they decided, oh, this is going to be my non-Senate person, this is going to be my more than 37 and a half hour person. What Senator Fumo decided was he was going to demand whatever he wanted, whatever he needed, from anybody. If it turns out that what he needed from somebody, say Christopher Craig, is to spend a couple hours on a legal thing, it would take a couple hours. If what he needed was somebody to run all of these affairs, and it would take up their entire time on the job, they were going to do that. And that's what happened here. And that's why you get how you get the result that you did. Another very telling thing about Jamie Spagna is that, remember, in 2004, when everything changes and they scramble to fix everything, one of the things they do is they tell her, right after she's been in the grand jury, you're not doing the political work anymore in the office. Suddenly, all of these accounts, all of these service filings, the Truman dinner, the invitations, everything that's been consuming her time, she takes it at home and does it at home. And says she even takes a day off for one of the big days when she's getting ready for the fundraisers. And what do? They give her $1,000 a month. I mean, get that. That's about a third raise that she gets, a one-third raise to do this. That alone tells you how much time it takes to do all this political stuff. They're going to give her $1,000 a month for what they suggest to Gina Novelli takes 2 hours. They didn't dare ask that leading question to Jamie Spagna, oh, you do lots more besides what's on Exhibit 26, because they would get the honest answer from her, which is she did what she did. She did what's listed there and what she was told to do. Part of it involves Citizens Alliance, and this is an important thing to go over. Later we're going to talk about the fraud on Citizens Alliance, which is taking all of the goods and services and everything else that you know about. But it's a fraud on the Senate as well. And you may ask, now, why is that? And I need to explain that. Contino and Faber both talked about it, which is you can't run an entity out of your Senate office, Citizens Alliance, that you profit from. And that's what they were doing. That's how Mr. Fumo had this set up. Mr. Kogan said in his opening, quote, assigning her, meaning Jamie, to work at Citizens Alliance, or it might have been referring to Ruth Arnao, I apologize, assigning her to work at Citizens Alliance is consistent with the legislative purpose, and the chief clerk will not disagree with that at all, is what you were told. Well, whoops, Mr. Faber did disagree with it vehemently. He said nobody is running a nonprofit, whether it's good nonprofit, bad nonprofit, out of a Senate office. We're a Senate office. If you want a separate business, you have a separate business. Contino was also very precise from the Ethics Commission. From his point of view, the problem is that the Ethics Act says you can't engage in a conflict of interest, which includes using the resources of the Senate for the benefit of yourself. That's what's happening here. If you're running Citizens Alliance and you're skimming off of it, you've got Jamie Spagna and Ruth Arnao running it as Senate employees. This is a clear violation of the law. When you add up what Citizens Alliance gave to Senator Fumo, it's probably about 5 to 10% of everything that came in the key years in question, including the PICO money. Any business would be delighted to get a profit of 5 to 10%. Ask the fellow who runs your gas station or the supermarket. That's what he's doing. What is very clever here. Occasionally you heard witnesses say that Senator Fumo did this or that was ingenious. This was ingenious. This was privatizing constituent service. This is constituent service. Citizens Alliance does great stuff. Clean the neighborhoods, clean graffiti, do a school. The Senate could make appropriations and do these things as public works, but he privatized it. He created a separate entity, Citizens Alliance, a separate 501c3 organization, and then he took goods for himself. You can't do that. In fact, it's kind of interesting that Mr. Contino told you that not only does Senator Fumo know about the Ethics Act, not only did he vote for it, but they had a meeting way back about 20 years ago where Senator Fumo wanted a couple of opinions that had just come out. And we marked them in evidence as 850 DNA. And it's interesting, what those opinions were about from the Ethics Commission was the prohibition on running a business out of your legislative office. And that's exactly what they were doing here with Citizens Alliance. Now, it turns out it's a fraud on citizens as well because you're taking all these goods that are not yours. But we'll get to that later. This is Jamie Spagna's job. Her job is the political accounts, the personal accounts, the Citizens Alliance accounts. She's the one who does the ordering. She's the one who calls or emails Amazon and Grainger and McMaster Carr and all these places that they're getting all the loot from and arranges so that it'll all be delivered to Senator Fumo. The cross-examination of Ms. Spagna was fascinating. It lasted all of 15 minutes. Mr. Jacobs asked her about her time. Asked her, well, did you work during lunch hour? Weren't there sometimes that you stayed afterwards? If Senator Fumo was in the office, did one of his little additions with all of the hours, and ended with a flourish and said, well, you give 42, 45, 50 hours. You give more than your share of time to the Senate. And she said, yes, she did spend that amount of time. But he never asked her, doing what? This is what she did. And she did it, perhaps, for more than 37 and a half hours. He did ask her about things that she did before she had this job with Ms. Arnao from 01 to 03. She worked on PITS, which is the thing upstairs that did both political and probably mostly political work. She did things after 2003. When Ms. Arnao left the Senate, she took on some of Ms. Arnao's responsibilities of going to meetings and some other matters, some boards that Ms. Arnao was on, she was now on. That was afterwards. Mr. Jacobs asked her when Ms. Spagna was on the stand, he said, now you and I, he said, just met last week. And that really struck me because she's a friendly witness. This is someone who's been a close friend of Mr. Fumo and Ms. Arnao for years. If she did Senate work from 2001 to 2003, they would have been meeting with her years ago and going over in detail and listing the Senate work that she did. He met with her to say hi a week before she got on the stand. Why is that? Because she has nothing to add. We would have been interested to know before the trial. Perhaps the charge would not have been made. It's not there. What's there is Exhibit 79, which is the work that she actually did. This case can really begin and end with Ms. Spagna. Mr. Kogan, and just one more phrase from his opening, he said, you're going to hear people like Jamie Spagna tell you about some of the missteps she made in her testimony and that she was in her eighth month of pregnancy. And they still brought her back to the grand jury again. And she's going to tell you what it was like to work for that man and what an honor it was and how these people broke their necks working for the state of Pennsylvania. You, of course, did not hear any of that. What you heard is what she might have broken her neck doing, which is all of this personal and political work. Now, while we're talking about Ms. Spagna, just briefly about Ms. Arnao. There's an important point here, and again, Ms. Arnao is not charged with this. Senator Fumo is, but Ms. Arnao is not putting in 37 and a half hours of work for the Senate either. Mr. Marone encapsulized it best. He said her job basically was to write checks. That's what she did. She was the treasurer for many years of Fumo for Senate. She handled the campaign accounts until Jamie took it over, as the campaign treasurer. She handled Citizens Alliance. What else did she do? Oh, sure, they paid her more and more. We'll talk later. They gave her higher and higher titles. She was making over $80,000 a year. But doing what? The only thing that you heard was that was working on the charter school, which was a great project. And you heard from Rosemary Doherty, the principal, who estimated that Ms. Arnao put in about 10 hours a week once that got started in 1999. But now she's also getting paid by Citizens Alliance. They start the charter school because they get all the money from PICO, and they start paying Ms. Arnao a salary because they get all the money from PICO. So it's all happening at the same time, which still leaves the question, what's she doing for the Senate for over $80,000 a year? And again, with all this time and all this ability to document this while Mr. Fumo is testifying, you don't hear one word about it because there's no evidence to present. We presented the evidence. Like I said, we have the burden. And so we asked everybody. Jamie Spagna said she doesn't know. She said, Ms. Arnao spends a lot of time out of the office. I don't know what she's doing. Gina Novelli said the exact same thing. Marianne Cortullo said that she handled some constituent requests. But when pressed to identify any of them, the only thing she could say was these liquor control board permits that came up and then stopped after there was some publicity in the newspaper. Lillian Cozzo, the secretary, wonderful lady, as you saw, who testified. Lillian Cozzo worked about 10 feet from Ruth Arnao's desk for 20 years. And we asked her, what did Ruth Arnao do? And she couldn't say. She did not know. Because the truth is, she didn't do Senate work. She was a very key person, like all of these others, put there in the basement on Tasker Street to be available for what Senator Fumo needed. Now, when you get to campaigns, you see her all over these emails. You remember that We Have a Primary email? I won't show it to you again. She, of course, is one of the people listed, along with the other group of reliable people. The point is ultimately irrelevant, because as we'll get back to, she is one of the severely overpaid people, even if she's doing any constituent work, like somebody might suggest, but we'll come back to that. Christian Marone, another person who spends time, at least for a couple years, on state time doing personal work for Senator Fumo. That personal work, of course, being the refurbishment, rebuilding of his mansion on Green Street. Now, it's interesting in this trial when we talk about Christian Marone, there is no lack of venom that is directed towards Mr. Marone, and you saw that. He was cross-examined for days, longer than other witnesses. The defense case, I think more than a quarter probably of the defense witnesses, were for the purpose of going after Christian Marone. Now, obviously, there are other things going on in the world that lead to that, besides any relevance of his testimony. I still don't know why Bruce Castor, the former district attorney of Montgomery County, was called as a witness. Bruce Castor said that Christian Marone had a family disagreement, didn't like Senator Fumo as a result. Well, there's news. He said that Mr. Marone wanted to get involved in Republican politics and get active when he went into his office. Marone told you that. He said that when Marone left, basically we learned that Marone went from one snake pit into another snake pit and lost his job at the district attorney's office because he backed the party-endorsed candidate, and Mr. Castor didn't like that. I think probably the only interesting thing we learned from Bruce Castor was confirmation that if you're going to exchange email with Christian Marone, you better watch what you say, because Mr. Marone is likely to keep his email. That is something that was confirmed with his testimony. But why do we have all these witnesses? Why is everybody going after Christian Marone? He said a lot of very important things, all of which was corroborated by other witnesses, most of which Senator Fumo even admitted by the time he took the witness stand. Marone said that Senator Fumo ran Citizens Alliance. That was a very important fact to the government back in 2004. Back when the government was being told part of what you'll hear later, I call defense number one, that Senator Fumo had nothing to do with Citizens. That was very useful to be able to sit down with Mr. Marone, get his emails, and see that. It's not even in dispute. Now, he told us that he and Ms. Arnao went on these shopping sprees at Sam's Club, these $1,000 shopping sprees, because he was there for some of it. But we heard that from Ms. Egri also, who was there. And now, of course, that's admitted. He told us that Lisa Costello was the maid, another thing that the government worked like crazy to see if it was true and to be able to prove. And now that the government has proven it, now it's admitted. He told us that Ruth Arnao didn't do any work for the Senate other than write checks. And like I just said, you heard that from numerous other witnesses. He told us about how Tasker Street was turned into Campaign Central over and over and over again, something you heard from everyone. And he told you about all the personal tasks that people did. You heard it from Ms. Egre. You heard it from Mr. Fonseca. You heard it from even defense witnesses who testified. What's the issue here with Christian Marone? The only thing that they dispute still is the time that he spent working on the refurbishment of Mr. Fumo's house. But again, Mr. Marone is the person who comes to the government in 2004. Doesn't even come to the government. He's approached by the FBI, decides to answer their questions, produces this material, opens up this world of information, all of which turns out to be precisely true. And yes, he is the person we rely on who then tells us, and I spent 80% of my time during the first 18 months working on the house. And that then is corroborated as well. We see, in fact, Mr. Fumo again admitted it. While Mr. Sendek pulls up Exhibit 383, these are the computer files from Mr. Marone regarding the work that he did. And you know it goes on for page after page after page of punch lists of what was being done in 1997 and 1998. And Mr. Fumo admits it. He even called it on the stand. He called it the Green Street Project. Imagine that. A state office had the Green Street Project to fix up his house. And he said, but Senator Fumo says, but he couldn't have spent that much time on it. Why? Well, one, because he doesn't know much about construction. Well, that was interesting, because it was only a few minutes before in his testimony that Senator Fumo praised Ruth Arnao for overseeing the construction of the expansion of the Christopher Columbus Charter School. He told you how they bought this bakery and decided we just have to start over, and she was the one who supervised the whole project. And Ms. Dougherty told you it took 10 hours a week. So that's interesting. Ruth Arnao can supervise the construction of a school, but Christian Marone cannot supervise the construction of a mansion on Green Street. That's the kind of testimony that was being given to you. The other thing that Mr. Fumo said is, well, I know all the other work he was doing, and he wouldn't be able to spend 80% of his time doing this. I'll talk about that in a minute. But then there were other witnesses. After they're done with days of cross-examination of Christian Marone, P.J. Harrison walks in. No bias, no favor for either side. He's a carpenter, nice guy. And what does he say? Christian Marone was the overseer. He's the guy who told everybody what to do. He's the guy who came once or twice a day and gave instructions to people and made sure everything was happening. And so he gets, and of course, Ms. Egre confirmed that, and the documents confirm it. You have page after page. This was no ordinary mansion. 33 rooms being converted from what used to be 6 apartments, a subterranean wine cellar, a gun range, a roof deck, heated sidewalks, and everything else that went along. Somebody needed to be the one to order all the contractors to make sure they were there when they're supposed to be there. You don't want the painter coming in before the carpenter has finished whatever woodwork is being done, making sure that all these unique products are being ordered. This is what Christian Marone did. And can you imagine? Mr. Fumo is admitting that he has this young man at a law school that he takes into his employment and puts him to work on the Green Street Project with no guidance, no tracking of his time. And we're supposed to believe that Mr. Fumo is acting in an honest and non-fraudulent way. I'm sure that you know that is not the case. So what do we have? Well, they say they found documents. They found documents that show that Mr. Marone was doing other things while he was also doing this. And this gets into a really interesting story, which involves the process servers. They did this stunt, and you can only call it a stunt, of subpoenaing Christian Marone for documents that they already had. And it's very important in a number of ways in looking at this case. That you heard this whole story about how the process servers went to his house, and Mr. Kogan made a big deal of it on the cross-examination of Mr. Marone. And then, lo and behold, after that, Mr. Marone produces documents to the government that had not been produced before, including many incriminating documents of most of these things you see regarding all of the work done on Green Street, but also what we call these police documents, documents about work that he did regarding the police department in 1997 and 1998 at the same time. Well, they made one little mistake, because when they showed this to Mr. Marone, what they used was Defense Exhibit 3-1. And Defense Exhibit 3-1 is a directory of what they said were these new files being produced by Marone. But there's one problem. It's not the directory of the files produced by Mr. Marone. It overlaps to a great deal. but it's different. This is something they had all along. They had all the police documents, and many to boot. There are many personal documents here about his education and about other things that are on their directory. And if you compare it to our directory of what Mr. Marone gave us, which is Government Exhibit 386, you'll see the differences. So what is going on here? They're sending out process servers for documents that they already have. They're knocking on his door at night. They're scaring his wife, who happens to be the defendant's daughter. His two grandchildren are inside. And what are they doing? What they're doing is they're trying to provoke some kind of reaction. They're hoping something happens that they can then use against Mr. Marone. This is ugly stuff. And it's all about documents that they had all along. Now, there's one other really important point to make about this. These are police, what we call the police documents, that I'll talk about what's actually in them. But the police documents are from 1997 and 1998. They have them. They've had them all along. They didn't need a subpoena to get them. They've been sitting on them for 10 years in case they ever have to take on anything Mr. Marone has to say. That's really important because later on, I'm going to be talking about all of the people for whom there are no documents. Frank Wallace, Howard Kane, Mike Palermo, Mitchell Rubin. What the police documents show you is that if documents did exist that showed that those people did legitimate Senate work, you'd have them. They kept everything they could keep that helps them, and their absence with regard to many, many other witnesses is very important, and we'll talk about that as we go along. But then the police documents themselves are really interesting. Senator Fumo said in his testimony, he said, Mr. Marone did a top-to-bottom study of the Philadelphia Police Department, and that's why he could not have had time to be spending 80% of his time working on my mansion. Well, look at it. You'll see them in evidence. They're defense exhibits. They're not every number, but they range sort of between number 1 and number 40, and there are only about 15 of them. And they're things like defense exhibit 6, which is two sentences long, just making a note to somebody about some piece of legislation. Or defense exhibit 14, where he sends a quote to a bike store to see if he can get a quote to buy some bikes for the Philadelphia Police Department. The only ones of any length. And then we have Defense Exhibit 9. This says that it's Bratton's crime-fighting strategy. Because what he's doing is he's been told, take a look at what Commissioner Bratton in New York City is doing and see if we're doing that in Philadelphia. And this is what he writes up. Something you could get out of a newspaper article, and I'm sure that's where he did get it, and you can type up in 10 minutes. And then he does two reports. One of them is Defense Exhibit 9.2. This is the longest. Now, we see that he learned well what they taught us in college, which is how to make a nice-looking cover page and center it and everything. But then if you go to the content of it, as our teachers usually did, you see what's here, which is three pages, which is essentially a newspaper article. In fact, he pretty much admits it, because if you look at the first sentence, he says, it's been the subject of a number of articles that have appeared in the Philadelphia Daily News. And if you read more of this, you'll see there's a reference to a New York Times article, which is obviously where much of this came from. You look at these, there are two reports that are three pages long, and you look at them, there is no independent research. There's no interview of anybody. There's no citation of any resource. This would not do very well in the college courses I attended, or probably most of the courses that other people in this room attended, because this didn't take very long. If you line these up and lay them down against those punch lists with the electricians and the carpenters and the tile layers and the painters and everybody else that he had to keep on top of, it's pretty obvious. In fact, don't even do that. Don't take my word for it. Don't take Mr. Kogan's word for it. Take these 15 police documents. Sit down with them. Read them to each other. And I suggest that when you're done, you'll be asking yourself, what did he do after the first 2 days, let alone during the rest of the 18-month period that we're talking about here? It's very, very strong and compelling when you actually read these, which was not done for you during the trial. But anyway, P.J. Harrison says he was the overseer. Now, they focus on Mr. Harrison's testimony where he said Marone would come by for an hour or so and say, okay, well, that means he's not spending the rest of his time. But that's actually totally consistent with Marone's testimony. It makes perfect sense. He told you he would stop by in the morning, he would see what was going on, he would put out the whatever notices he needed for the men, and he'd go back to the office and he would do more work. He needed to find the fixtures and the heated sidewalks and all the other stuff that was going on. And then the afternoon, he'd pop by again. He honestly told you that when this project was done at the end of 1998 and the family was able to move in, he did finally start get to do the things he wanted to do. He worked on the Avenue of the Arts and the Passyunk Avenue revitalization and the high-tech incubator. But always, always, Green Street was his first priority because that's what he was put in charge of. If we look at Defense Exhibit 728, this is pretty interesting. We had done a summary, you may remember, Exhibit 261, where we just list, so you have a guide, the emails that we have that are Christian Marone doing things for the Green Street House. I actually like their version better because what they did with their version is they put in the dates, not just the exhibit numbers, but the dates. And what it shows you is that all of the emails that are in existence that Mr. Marone printed out and gave to us, which is the only reason we have them, are from the beginning of 2000 on. We have nothing from before 2000. And that's because, as he told you, email wasn't as prevalent then. They also changed servers. A lot of this was done by memos that Kozo would type out, and then he would write on them and send them back. So the emails we have are from 2000 on, and look at what we have. We have dozens and dozens of emails. If you look at Exhibit 278, for example, where Mr. Fumo is regularly directing Christian Marone to do things for him that relate to Green Street. Here the tunnel is leaking again. He wants him to go out and find people who can fix this at last, and maybe we should sue the waterproofing guy. I mean, who can forget the other email? I'm not going to show it to you again, but the leaks, FFF, I mean, that was part of the same thing. Exhibit 288, he tells Mr. Marone, please put together a schedule of what has to be done at Green Street and when it will be started and completed. This is after the house is done, but it's quite a project in and of itself to take care of a 33-room mansion that they're continuing to work on. Exhibit 300, he's looking after the wine cellar, and he also attaches an update list of everything that they're working on. 316, he's directed, go find somebody from the Academy of Music here who can help them with this issue regarding the gas lamp in front of the house. It never ends. But what this shows you is that Marone is completely credible. This is the guy who's directing him to do these things. When there was a lot to do, when the house is being built, he did a lot. When there was less to do, he did this. But always, Senator Fumo is directing this state employee who was only paid with state funds to do these things. Luckily for us, he kept his email. Luckily for us, he printed it out, and you're able to see it. Not everything that was happening back then, but enough to show you very clearly. It was interesting. He said he was asked, why did you keep your email? Why did you print it out? And he said, because I knew that a day would come that, if any of this is exposed, they're going to blame me. And I need to have this to protect myself. He did not go to the FBI. He didn't print it out and go to Castor's office and hand it over to the district attorney. He kept it until the FBI came calling for him 2 years later. And that's when we got all of this information. And you know what? He was exactly right. Because look what they kept. They kept the police records. Any memo, no matter how old. Remember, there's that memo about him having a spat with Ruth Arnao? It's from 2000. They have it. There was a memo with Charlie Hoffman listing his job duties after Green Street was mostly done. They have it. It's not deleted. It's not wiped. It's not destroyed. Like I said before, it's a surgical strike. They want you to see what they want you to see, and they don't want you to see what they don't want you to see. I will never forget that email regarding Aunt Nancy. That where there was an email from 2002 between Christian Marone and his fiance, Nicole Marone. And so Senator Fumo is illegally tapping his daughter's email, reading his daughter's email with her fiance. And there's this pretty nasty note that Christian Marone writes where the email that was forwarded was from Senator Fumo to his family members that said, Aunt Nancy passed away this morning. And it said something like, may she rest with God. And Marone, obviously the times are bad at this point, and he responds only to his wife and says something like, God, he doesn't believe in God. And what happens with that email? That he intercepts it, he prints it out, he gives it to his lawyer to bring it into court to try to dirty up Christian Marone with this email. What you learn, ladies and gentlemen, is that Christian Marone knew exactly who he was dealing with. And luckily for us, he printed out these emails, as he said, to protect himself. And that's why you know the way in which his services were misused when he was a state employee. The next area, we've talked about the Spagna, we've talked about Arnao, Mr. Marone. Let me talk briefly a little bit more about the computer workers. Like I, and here again, whatever Mr. Fumo wants, he asks for. It's all part of this persistent scheme to just take what he can take, regardless of when it's done or by whom it's done. And I said, you have this great contrast between Lechko and Wilson. Lechko will do anything, Wilson won't. In fact, Wilson testified to you that he spent half of his time at the office during regular work hours on eBay. He's into motorcycles and automotive things, and he's perhaps buying and selling all day long. So he doesn't even have enough to keep him busy for 37 and a half hours, even if he doesn't do anything personal for Senator Fumo. Now, did someone say at that point, hey, maybe we don't need a second full-time taxpayer-paid computer support person here? Did someone say, maybe we should do what everyone else in the state does? You heard about how every other senator shares tech people who go from office to office? No, because what Mr. Fumo wants, he's going to take. And what he wants is that if there's ever a time that a computer is broken or he wants something personally, there better be somebody there to deal with it. Wilson better be there to put in the Xbox in his home office or to install the navigation equipment or the other radio equipment on his boat or to go to Florida and do the weather station and the computer and the things in the cars and the other things that he worked on. I mean, this is just outrageous. And it just went on and on, month after month after day. I mean, what you want to think about this case, think about Don Wilson standing on the roof of the senator's house in Florida, probably with one eye looking at the Atlantic and with the other making sure he doesn't lose his balance while he's 1,000 miles away from the job that the taxpayers of Pennsylvania are paying him to do. That's what this case is about. Now, while we're talking about computers and things, very briefly, you heard, just to be clear about what's charged and what's not charged, you heard a lot about all this Senate equipment that's everywhere with respect to Senator Fumo. He's got four houses. He's got the docks in Monmouth. There are laptops and desktops at every place, printers. Everything is set up, even at his Dilworth office. They're paying him $900,000 a year, but no, he's got to have Senate equipment paid for by the Senate. That is not charged because he does work for the Senate. It's crazy. Laptops, I thought, were invented so that you can take it from one place to another. No, he needs to have a laptop and desktop in the same house, in five different houses. At Dilworth, he told you, well, there were two times that they had meetings there of senators to discuss the budget. So for those two times, nobody could just bring a laptop or more to work on it. No, they have to put in a desktop, laptop, printer that's regularly serviced and updated by these computer people. What it is it's gluttony. And what it does is it demonstrates to you the intent and the state of mind behind all of this, even if that part of it we're not alleging is illegal by itself, given that he's the person using it. As for Mr. Wilson, he and the other computer people, they gave computer equipment to people who did not work for the Senate. They serviced the computers of other people who were not Senate workers. And who were they? You know who they were. They were anybody that Senator Fumo wanted to get this special treatment, even if it's on the taxpayer's dime. His wife while they were married, his girlfriends while at different times, his daughter, anyone gets this special service free of charge at the expense of the taxpayers. It's all the same story over and over and over again. Wilson not only worked on the boats, he installed wireless equipment for Miss Arnao at the shore. He went to Mitchell Rubin's office. He went to Howard Kane's home. He hooked up security cameras that were at the shore. I had exhibits listed here. I'll leave it to you to look at them. They're all listed out. It just went on and on. They helped these Senate employees, Lechko and Wilson, helped him spy on Dottie Eggery. On Senate time, they set it up so that they put a keylogger on her computer at one point so he could track all the strokes so you could see what she's typing and what she's doing, what websites she's going to. They backed up her whole computer over and over. You remember that email where they were worried because they fixed her computer and had told her we have to pay somebody to recover the data. And they were worried, how do we explain to her that we had the data all along because we back up her computer all the time so you can read it? And what they decided, what Lutschko and Wilson settled on was they would just lie to Dottie and say to her that Fumo spent $1,500 to send the computer out to get the data recovered when really it was the data that they had all along. And I'm sure she was very grateful for hearing about that, not having any idea of what these state employees were doing. They printed all of her email. Remember, they had a time they had 9 boxes of all of her email printed out to make it easier to go through, and they left it in the senator's office. You know, you just had times when you're talking about this, you just have to stop and, and catch your breath. These are state employees on state time doing these things. Wilson went and worked for the Kerry campaign. He was put on campaigns over and over again, he told you. He put together speakers for the senator's reelection campaign in 2004. For the Kerry campaign, they just said go. They just said go. There's this office set up leading up to Election Day in November of 2004, and he was there for 7 or 8 days. In fact, in very un-Don Wilson-like fashion, he said he worked really long hours. He actually worked more than 40 hours. And so the Kerry campaign gave him $1,000 when it was over on top of the Senate pay that he was getting for his regular work week. Senator Fumo, once again, just like with Ms. Spagna, in his testimony, did not say anything about Don Wilson other than he didn't know what he did or when he did it. Mr. Kogan, when he was cross-examining Mr. Wilson, didn't have anywhere to go with this because the guy obviously is not going to work more than 37 and a half hours. So trying to minimize it, said, well, would you agree that you spend about 1 to 2 days a month on personal matters if you add it up in the aggregate? And Mr. Wilson agreed with that, so it sounds like a good estimate. Well, now that left out all this political work. So let's go with 2 days a month. Let's accept that. The 2 days a month is what he spent doing these things. Well, 2 days a month is 24 days a year. That's about 5% of a person's regular work days. It's 10%. Don Wilson was making over $50,000 a year from the Senate. So that's $5,000 right there. Before you get into the problem that we have no time records. Nobody was told to keep any records about any of this that was going on. A last word about the computer people. Mike Podgorski, you remember, was another witness. Another guy, doesn't like us too much. Did not want to answer any questions on direct examination. Shown emails where he gave a new laptop to Dottie Eggery, a new Senate laptop. Even Mr. Fumo admits it now, given the emails in black and white. Says it was wrong, but another one of those things that he says was no big deal. Podgorski couldn't remember that, couldn't remember all sorts of other things. And then we called Agent Humphreys, and she explained to you that, yeah, he had told us all these things that he did. Now, he was interesting. He said, I worked, I think he said 5 to 7 hours a week would be personal things. That was his estimate. But, he said, I put in 50 to 70 hours a week. Imagine that, 70 hours a week, he said, doing this job. And therefore, I'm putting in more than my 37 and a half hours. And everything is okay. Now, besides looking at his demeanor, I mean, one of the things you obviously do as jurors is you look at the witnesses, you assess not only what they say, but how they say it and what their demeanor is. And his demeanor said an awful lot. But even putting that aside, just think about the facts. 50 to 70 hours a week. He had the same job as Don Wilson. Don Wilson took over his job. He had Lenny Lutschko, the craziest, most dedicated computer support person that you could have working with you. Podgorski's job was, he said, it was to handle Mr. Fumo's computers, which means Green Street, Kenyon Avenue, the docks, and in his office, and research new technology. That was his job. Lutschko handled everything else. Lutschko handled all the rest of the staff. Well, how often can a computer break? How much new technology comes out? This is a Senate office that has word processing and spreadsheets. That's what they do. He didn't work 50 to 70 hours a week, just like Don Wilson, who was more honest with you, told you. He didn't work 50 to 70 hours a week. It's probably about the same percentage breakdown. In fact, and this is most interesting, Mr. Podgorski told you that he now works less hours. He said it's 45 to 50 hours a week, servicing 13 Senate offices in eastern Pennsylvania, where he drives up and down the eastern part of the state. That's the testimony that he gave you. It's pretty obvious what was going on in this office at that point in time. Next topic I'm going to discuss with you as we go through the employees are the drivers. You heard from the witnesses that there's one senator in the state of Pennsylvania who had a driver for medical reasons because she was disabled. No one else other than Senator Fumo had a driver. He had three. He had Dave Nelson, Lou Leonetti, and Charlie Shoulders in Harrisburg. Again, in focusing on what's charged and what's not charged, we are not alleging that it's wrong to use one of these gentlemen as a driver to take him to Senate meetings and to even to drive him to Harrisburg or what have you when he can do work in the car while that's happening. Is it a great use of resources? I don't know. You can debate that, but it's certainly not something that we're alleging. And if that's all that happened, once again, as I often say, we would not be here. But what did happen? What else did these people do? That's the question. And how much were they paid? That's the real fraud, which we'll talk about when we go through the details of all of these individuals. That vacation chart is really important. That I think it was 894, the exhibit about Florida, where you see that Senator Fumo is out of the state 25% of the time. He's down at the shore at least another 50 days of the year, probably more, on these very long weekends. Nelson and Leonetti, remember, are assigned to Philadelphia. Nelson, when it was time to go to Harrisburg, would drive him to Harrisburg on a Monday morning and turn around and get on the train and come back because they had Shoulders to drive him in Harrisburg. So you've got anywhere between 50 and 80 session days in Harrisburg. Add that all together, and there's probably a third or less of the days during the year that Mr. Fumo is in Philadelphia, where he can be driven by Dave Nelson or Lou Leonetti. What are they doing the rest of the time? And not only that, why are there two of them? Dave Nelson told you he worked hard when Mr. Fumo was around. Sometimes they'd be out late at night. Okay, you have to do that a third of the year? Fine. What's Lou Leonetti doing? It was fascinating when Nelson said, well, he has the same job I do. Mr. Fumo never mentioned Lou Leonetti. Now, Nelson says when he's not driving, what's he doing? He said he would stock the refrigerator with soda. He would take things to City Hall. He would order trash bags. I mean, this is what he did. He did whatever he could find to do. If somebody had an errand to run, how many errands are there to run? You've got three constituent services people, plus Charlie Hoffman on the first floor. Pacello, Arnell, people when they're there in the basement doing what they're doing. How much is there to do? The reason he didn't explain to you any specifics is because there are no specifics. And what's Leonetti doing? How much soda can they drink? What you have here, again, it's just gluttony. But this gluttony is at the expense of the taxpayers. It's not hard to figure out what happened here. And I just make this as a suggestion. You're allowed to make inferences from the evidence. What happens, of course, is that there must have been one day where, oh my gosh, for whatever reason, Dave Nelson was not there to drive the senator where he wanted to go. And they went out and hired another guy, another full-time person with full benefits from the state of Pennsylvania, making more than $30,000 a year up towards $50,000 if you include the benefits. This is how they did things. This is what I mean when I said Fumo World. It's just a place of its own, apart from the ordinary reality and the ordinary laws. What they did, other than sitting around, other than playing solitaire, as Mr. Nelson admitted in the grand jury, or looking up travel websites, is whatever came up that could be done for him. You saw Exhibit 640. Again, we can only rely on the emails that survive. But Exhibit 640, please have David get me a box of ammunition for Dottie's gun, and I'll take it to the shore with me on Thursday. Exhibit 646, Mr. Fumo, or maybe it was Dottie complaining. It was Dottie. David and Lou just brought a box of candles here at Green Street. However, they're 3 inches in diameter and 6 inches high. The one we currently have in the fireplaces are 3 inches in diameter and 3 inches high. Can you imagine that? This is what these gentlemen are doing. And remember, Nelson and Leonetti's email, completely gone. Obviously, that's how they all communicate, and you won't see it. And that's where I said at the beginning, the obstruction colors everything in this case and shows their knowledge of the wrongdoing that took place. Lillian Kozo, she's sort of the air traffic controller of 1208 Green Catastrophe. She's the one sending people out and telling them what to do. Would you like to see her emails day in and day out giving the instructions to Mr. Nelson and Mr. Leonetti? You won't, because it's all gone, because the only email we can see of Ms. Kozo is what was kept by Tom Colosimo, the electrician. Now, you heard from witnesses about things that happened, about how Nelson and Leonetti would drive Miss Eggery to the airport, how they'd pick up Allie for her weekly visitation, how they would drive 30 miles or 30 minutes out to Dick Sprague's house because Mr. Fumo liked the way the person there did the dry cleaning. This is how they filled their time, and they also must have filled their time with just a lot of sitting around. This is, once again, an outrage. But now, can you calculate how much time they spent? Can you calculate how much personal stuff they did as opposed to driving him, as opposed to sitting around? It would be difficult, and luckily in this case it's not necessary, because what you have is this giant overpayment to them, much like with many of these other employees. And by the way, it was not your average run-of-the-mill employees who were overpaid. The budget analysts in Harrisburg got paid as budget analysts. The constituent service people, you can see them listed on Mr. Fumo's spreadsheet that he kept, they were paid as constituent service people. The people taking it in above what their normal jobs permitted are the loyal people in the basement who created this fraud. It's Nelson and Leonetti and Arnao and Pacello and Spagna and Novelli, and we'll talk about all that in a bit more detail very soon. But if you look at Exhibit 635, for example, which are the sheets that Mr. Dugalecki had to fill out, that the loyal guy in Harrisburg who would write anything for whatever crazy salary Mr. Fumo wanted to give people. And this is what he wrote about Mr. Nelson. He performs public contact work with gathering gathering information, resolving complaints, engendering support for policy initiatives. Now, they tried to justify it here by saying he's out at meetings and he takes down people's names and he comes into the office the next day and hands the names over to whoever's going to work on it. This is a lie. You want to know, the judge told it to you in the legal terms. I'll tell it to you in the factual terms. Legally, a scheme to defraud is where you make false statements, usually to get a benefit for yourself, in furtherance of a fraudulent scheme, and you use the U.S. mail or an interstate wire communication. That's what we're here for. Those are federal crimes. This is fraud, is when you write down false information, because if Russ Faber gets the true information, if he gets a piece of paper that says, Dave Nelson is my driver, he stocks the refrigerator with soda, he carries my coat in from the car, which is another one of the things Mr. Nelson said in his testimony, he's not getting paid what somebody gets paid to resolve complaints and engender support for policy initiatives and assist and coordinate various other management functions and advise on procedures. And there's another one just like this in the file. I asked Mr. Dugalecki when he was on the stand, I asked him, why not tell the chief clerk what Dave Nelson did? And Mr. Dugalecki's amazing response that we wrote down, he said, to what end? That was his answer. Well, I'll tell you to what end. In order to deal honestly with the clerk and deal honestly with the funds of the people of Pennsylvania. Then we have Lisa Costello, who's the maid. Now everybody agrees that's what she did. It wasn't always that way. We sort of had a moving defense as we went through the trial. Christian Marone took the stand and said, she's the maid. Yes, she had this Senate job. She worked in this satellite office on Clearfield Street where no one really knew what she did. But I saw her at the house regularly on Green Street being the maid once the house was open and people had moved in. And the cross-examination was, oh, no, you don't understand. She was there for meetings. She was there to serve Danish to people while they were at meetings. And that was a Senate function that she was there for. And Mr. Marone, he said, well, you haven't met Ms. Costello. He said, she might not be the person that you want to be serving Danish. And then P.J. Harrison comes in. And P.J. Harrison says, she's the maid. And then Dottie Eggery came in and said, she's the maid. And so the evidence about that starts to pile up. Ms. Eggery also importantly talked about a time that everybody got involved in the cleaning. She told you that, and no one contradicted this. Actually, in fact, it's interesting. As much as they go after Christian Marone's testimony, everyone seems to be on the same page that Ms. Eggery is an honest person. She came across as not trying to really help or hurt one side or the other. She obviously had very strong feelings for Mr. Fumo at one point in time. She didn't want to be here. She didn't answer the FBI's calls. She told you things about his personality that she wanted you to hear. She told it like it is. But the thing is that, and she's not some love-struck person who's dumped or anything. She's a respectable woman who has her own business and has her own life. always maintained her own home and her own business. Completely credible witness, and I think the defense agrees with that. And she testified for over a day about all of this, about the personal tasks, the demands, the campaigns. Pretty much her testimony and Marone's testimony are identical without the family animosity. They're pretty much otherwise, it's all the same. And she told an interesting story about when they moved into the house on Green Street, that she was in charge and brought the whole crew from Tasker, that Ruth Arneo and Gina Novelli and Lillian Kozo and Lisa were all there for a week to watch while this giant cleanup took place from top to bottom after Jane Fumo moved out of the house. This is the kind of thing they did. This is Fumo Incorporated. And so we look at the records, Exhibit 391, which is our summary regarding payments relating to a maid. And we see that Rita Jensen was the maid every single week. They'd write four checks a month and then probably give it out to her once a week. And if we go to the next page and further, we see that in March of 2000, it ends, the last payment to Rita Jensen. And then we heard from Nicole Barrett. Nicole Barrett started in May of 2002 when she was hired by Ruth Arneo, of course, the Senate employee, to be the new maid on Tasker Street. And she told you that she was paid in cash. And so there are no checks to her listed here. So you have a two-year gap where who's the maid? Obviously, Senator Fumo is using a maid. He's not cleaning himself. In fact, for the first 8 months on this that are covered by this, until December 1 of 2000, Jane and Allie Fumo are living there also. So everybody's there who's been there during the time that Rita Jensen is there. They obviously have a maid once a week, and it obviously continues. And Nicole Barrett comes in and says, I clean once a week, started out once a week, and I did what Lisa Costello, you know, gave me the guidance on what to do. Clearly, Lisa Costello was the once-a-week maid during this time. And so finally, there are other emails I could show you, but finally we get the admission that, oh, yes, she was the maid. That's what Senator Fumo testified. But he said a couple things that were very interesting, and none of them true. He said, well, she didn't clean that often. Do you believe that? Do you believe that he had a weekly maid before and he had a weekly maid after and he lived without a weekly maid? There are 16 checks regarding Lisa Costello cleaning at Kenyon Avenue, where obviously when she went down the shore and she did it on her time, she got paid for it and she got the checks. And those are spread out over a two-year period. Mr. Pease showed during the testimony that it matches up identically to the pattern of checks to the maid at Kenyon who took over, or actually did it before and after Ms. Costello was cleaning at Kenyon Avenue. So Mr. Fumo said, oh, no, Lisa is cleaning 1 or 2 hours a week on Green Street. I doubt you believe that. But then even on top of that, he says, and some of these checks relating to Kenyon Avenue must have been miscoded. Now it's Jamie Spagna or Gina Novelli's fault. They must have had, it says Kenyon, but it really must have been for Green Street. Well, you know that's not true, because when you look at that summary, you see there are a number of times Lisa Costello gets checks for other properties besides Kenyon Avenue that are on other pages. And they managed to change the categorization for that. But there's a bigger reason that you know that it's not true. And that is that what happens is the categorization here, you saw Mr. Fumo's tax returns. And you know that what these Quicken records are used for is to do the tax accounting that's done at the end of the year. If Gina Novelli and Jamie Spagna and Ruth Arneo were so incompetent in handling these Quicken records, his tax records would be a shambles. Nothing would be categorized the right way. What he's suggesting is that somebody puts in Quicken the category of Kenyon Avenue the first time, and then it pops up as a suggestion the next time you write a check to this person, and they leave it. Well, if they did that for every check he wrote, his accounting records would just be absolute bedlam. But we asked Jamie Spagna, did anybody ever tell you you did anything wrong? No, they never told her that. They kept using her on the personal accounts all the way until 2008. Obviously, this story is being made up after the fact. But there's one other fact that really, really takes care of this. And that is the idea that he also said, well, okay, besides checks, you know, we have this moving defense. I gave her cash, much like Nicole Barrett, after her, got cash to clean once a week. So that's the explanation. That's why Lisa Costello is cleaning, not because she's doing this as part of her Senate job. Well, there's one obvious problem there, and that is that who gave her the cash? whoever would have given cash to Lisa Costello, like Nicole Barrett, would not be Vince Fumo. He's not there. He's not in town over half the year. And even when he is, this isn't what he handles. He has Senate employees to handle this. When Nicole Barrett gets paid cash once a week, she testified. What did she do? She went over to Green Street. She saw Jamie Spagna or Roseanne Pacello, and they gave her the cash. They ran this part of his life the same way they ran every other part of his life. So if Lisa Costello were getting cash to clean Green Street, there would be a witness who could come in here other than Vince Fumo, and presumably we would have found this witness at some point, to say, I gave cash to Lisa Costello. It didn't happen. What happened is what's clearly depicted by these records. Lisa Costello was the maid during this two-year gap. She was willing to clean. She was willing to clean for extra money down the shore. And she was willing to take a day a week from her Senate job at the satellite office to clean, exactly as all of the other witnesses told you that she did. The next topic involves the farm. Now this gets back to Harrisburg. I told you before that in general, when we talk about this Senate fraud and overpaying employees and using their Senate time, that in general, this case is not about Harrisburg, because that's where you have these professional people who are working, you know, crazy hours at some parts of the year and full-time at other parts of the year. But he gets a farm 20 miles from Harrisburg. And now he needs help. And what do you see? You see the same thing that you always see, all hands on deck. Marianne Cortullo becomes the paymaster. She has the account. She writes over $500,000 worth of checks relating to the farm during just about a 15-month period. She's real friendly with Mr. Fumo still. She came in and told you that all of that stuff took 15 minutes a week, is what she said. You can evaluate that when you look at the evidence. Jerry Sable volunteers or is asked and goes out and does all the organization regarding the farm. Charlie Shoulders moves to the farm and pitches in getting everything ready. Sue Scott-Nicky, the secretary, does all manner. You have dozens of emails that you can look at that survive of everything that she's supervising and making sure it gets together. Allison Pinto is riding out to the farm every day with Ms. Scott-Nicky, also researching goat meat, and Vince Rossi is given some assignments regarding that as well. It's the same thing you see everywhere. We're going to ask people to do whatever it is that Mr. Fumo needs. Nobody keeps track. Nobody asks a favor. Nobody knows when it's being done. All they care about is that it gets done to help Mr. Fumo. Scott-Nicky and Pinto go to the farm two or three times a week for over a year. Can you imagine that? And we're supposed to believe that they're happy volunteers. This is how they want to spend their lunch hours. I mean, these are the kinds of things that were said to you during the trial from the witness stand. Jerry Sable may get the prize for a single piece of false testimony during the trial. If we look at Exhibit 434, this was the one where he gets into the problem with Duke Galecki because he's spending too much time on the farm. And if we look at the first part of this, we won't have time to read all of this again, but he sat here and he testified to you and he said, I spent at most 4 hours a month doing what I was doing regarding the farm. And he wrote this email to Senator Fumo saying, this is no game for me, Vince. I can either be sitting here writing budget questions or doing the farm stuff, but I can't do both. And you remember at the end of the redirect examination, I read this to him one more time, and I said, one more chance. You know, are you saying 4 hours a month is what you're spending at the farm? And he kind of looked down, and he looked up, and he said, yes. And he stuck to the testimony, which is obviously ridiculous testimony. He's spending his time developing this man's farm during the early months of 2003. Even Duke Galecki, who's usually seemed to be ready to apologize for anything, wasn't backing him up on it. He said Sable wasn't around. He was retiring. He was saying the heck with it, and I have to get him back to work the budget questions. This is what's going on, but the response is even more fascinating. When you go to Exhibit 435, what is Senator Fumo's response here? At the bottom, Jerry, I'm disappointed in all this. Your duties to the committee come absolutely first and foremost. And then he says, I cannot and will not pay you with taxpayer money to do work on the farm. Fascinating, because you know they did this whole thing with Sable about how supposedly he had 10,000 hours accumulated over 20 years by working extra hours at the set, and how he still was working long hours at this time, and he's got all this time built up. But Senator Fumo doesn't say to him, well, you've got 10,000 hours saved up. He doesn't say to him, well, you know, you volunteered and this is your personal time. He doesn't say, well, you're making me a more effective senator, and therefore this is okay. No. He's got somebody looking over his shoulder, Dugalecki, and what does this tell you? He knows exactly what the rules are, the exact same rules that we're enforcing in this trial, when he says, I will not pay you with taxpayer money to do work on the farm. And so what happens? Dugalecki is content. He gets Sable to come back and work on some budget questions, and he thinks everything's fine. But now Mr. Kogan showed Dugalecki this email and not the next one. Same thing happened when Mr. Fumo was on direct. Exhibit 436, when Sable's not giving up, he responds, I can do this. I'm the best guy you have. I like doing it. I want to do it. Enough with the budget questions. And Mr. Fumo's response is, okay, you just must put your committee work before anything like the farm. So get your committee work done and then go do whatever you want. And then the next email after that, Exhibit 437, this is 5 days later. Sue Sweat sends an email to Jerry Sable saying that Senator Fumo asked that you start getting Charlie involved in the farm stuff so that when you retire, he can take over. In other words, Dugalecki's not there. He's not looking anymore. He thinks everything is solved. But what's Senator Fumo thinking about? What he's thinking about is who's going to do this farm work for me. This is black and white stuff. This is not volunteering. This is not one happy family. This is what you see throughout the case, making sure that Mr. Fumo's work gets done. It was interesting when Dugalecki was asked about this, he tried to defend it and said, no, I never saw it. Mr. Fumo didn't tell me about this. But, he said, I find this hard to believe because I don't believe that Charlie Shoulders, the guy he said was his friend, I don't believe Charlie Shoulders could do this, that he could take over what Sable was doing. And my question was, do this? You know, what? Order feed? Make sure that the guy constructing the barn is there at the right time? You know, make sure the different workers do what they need to do. And Dugalecki said, no, it's just beyond his capability. It gets real interesting in a few minutes when we look at what Shoulders was being paid. Dugalecki's the same guy approving him as one of the top administrative officers in the Senate just so that he can get $50,000 or more a year. I mean, it tells you an awful lot about some of the testimony that you heard. And, of course, Dugalecki was not aware at all of the many emails, which I won't go through again, where Scott Nicky, just on a daily basis, is handling the organization of the farm from the office, much in the way that Marone did the exact same thing back in 97 and 98 regarding the construction of the mansion. Then we have, as far as Charlie Shoulders goes, Mr. Shoulders, in many ways, is just like Nelson and Leonetti. What does he do? He drives the senator when he's there, but that's less than a quarter of the year that they have these session days. He admits that he does the shopping and gets the dry cleaning and picks up prescriptions and does all the other things that other Senate employees do for Mr. Fumo in Philadelphia. Now, he actually does have a job when Mr. Fumo is not there, but it's not very demanding. His job is to take whatever forms come in from the district office that need to go to PennDOT and walk over and stand in line and get them processed so people get a little faster service. And he said some days there's a lot, some days there's not much, and that's pretty much his job. He also fills out the invoices. He types a sentence that gets stuck on top of every invoice that's getting processed. This is what he did, and you'll see later what he got paid for. But the real question is, what did he do while they had the farm? They had him move on the farm. And he was interviewed by the agents, and he said, when the Senate was not in session, many days, I was at the farm. And then he testified in the grand jury, and he said, 80% of the days during that year, when the Senate was not in session, I would stay at the farm or I would go out to the farm because my wife needed help. And it makes perfect sense. He told you his wife was out there. She was supposed to do this on her own in exchange for $200 a week, which is what they finally resolved with her. And he said, this farm work is 24/7 work. He said, you know, city slickers do not understand that. And yet, the minute the cross-examination started, he backed off. And he started to agree, oh, no, it wasn't 80%. No, I wasn't out there. I was confused. I didn't understand the questions that were being asked. Well, how confusing is the question, how much time did you spend out at the farm? How confusing is it to say, when the Senate was not in session, were you at the farm? Those are the questions he's been asked consistently. And you can weigh for yourself when it is that he was giving the accurate answer. Knowing what you know about Senator Fumo and the way everybody worked around him, I think you know exactly what the right answer is. In fact, they called the security guards who sit several floors away. I'm really not quite sure what that was about. To say, yeah, Shoulders is around a lot. They don't know where he was during that particular year. And we're not saying that Shoulders didn't go in every day. The key is that it's non-session days. This is not consecutive. In other words, what he's telling you is, or what he was telling the grand jury, is that when the Senate's in session, usually Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, he needs to be at the Senate office. His job is to be there for Senator Fumo when he needs to be driven somewhere. If the Senate is not in session, Senator Fumo is not in Harrisburg. And on those days, he could spend more time. It all makes perfect sense. And, of course, the security guards are not going to notice or remember from 2003, 2004 what's happening on this irregular pattern. The person who does remember is Christian Sura. Christian Sura is our honest, well-meaning young guy who goes off to Monster.com to get a job. He remembers, because this was one of the 2 years that he was there, from 03 to 04, and he remembers that Shoulders would disappear, he said, for long periods of time where nobody knew where he was during that final year that Sura was there, because that's the year that coincided exactly with the farm. In fact, Mr. Shoulders, on direct examination, even said, before he started going the other direction, he even said that he left the farm, but the reason he was asked to leave is because it was interfering with his Senate work, because there was so much time involved in it. The other interesting thing about it is the emails that we showed you. Remember, in October of 03, Mr. Fumo and others are complaining about the work that Mr. and Mrs. Shoulders are doing out on the farm. And that's when Scott Nicky and Pinto go out for the first time, and Pinto writes this scathing report about the condition of the horses and how they're keeping them up. And then, I won't read all of them to you now, but what happens is they decide that Duga Leckie has that amazing email where he says, we're going to go out and check. You know, he tells Fumo, this is your list, and you need to make sure it gets done, and we're going to sit on Shoulders and make sure that he does all this work. And then Shoulders sends an email to Fumo saying, Margaret and I need to meet with you, just you, me, and Margaret. And the response from Fumo is, no, meet with Paul. What is going on here? These are Senate employees, Duga Leckie, Pinto, Scott Nicky, who are riding Shoulders. Why? Because this is part of the Fumo Senate operation. It might not have anything to do with the Senate of Pennsylvania, but this is the way everything that gets run. And none of this addresses the fact that during these years, Mr. Shoulders' salary for doing what he does keeps going up and up and up, over $40,000 a year, over $50,000 a year. We'll go over that in a little bit. This might I could keep talking, as you know, for forever, but I think we should probably finish.
Are we leaving the farm temporarily?
We're off the farm, right?
Okay, well then we'll take a break.
All right, just to wrap up, talking about the employees before we move on to the contractors, we're going to go back to the Ward headquarters for a moment and talk about Roseanne Pacello and Marianne Cortullo. Ms. Cortullo testified before you. She was also somewhat hostile to us, another one of these very, very loyal people for Senator Fumo. And she pretty much could not tell you much of what Roseanne Pacello did. All we heard, even though she worked for her for 13 years, we heard that Ms. Pacello meets with constituents, but without any specifics. Apparently, the way this was set up was that if you were politically connected, if you were one of the committee people or something else, you could get special access to Ms. Pacello to handle instead of having to talk to one of the constituent service people on the first floor. We heard that Ms. Pacello took vacation all summer. For a while, she had another job even with the school district as a truant officer. But we'll give the benefit of the doubt that she spent 37 and a half hours a week at various times working on constituent matters. And Marianne Cortullo, all that she did was act as the assistant to Ms. Pacello, besides handling things for Senator Fumo, various bank accounts, the farm account, the accounts of the business ventures that Ms. Pacello and Mr. Fumo had together, the tax returns. She ordered guns for him. She was the gun expert as a former police officer. Again, you just have this padded staff in the basement of people who are there to help Mr. Fumo. We'll never know, of course, everything that they did because their computers were wiped, and we never got anything. It would be wonderful to have the same kind of look into Marianne Cortullo's computer that we do into Jamie Spagna's, but that is not to be because of the obstruction that took place. But this leads us in, this is the right place to talk about this overpayment, which is the other big part of the fraud that's alleged in the first part of the indictment. Not just the many people I've talked about so far, like Spagna and Marone and Nelson and Leonetti and Costello, who did non-Senate things during Senate time, but the way in which these favored people were also way overpaid in order to engender their loyalty. And it's a very important part of the case. If we look at Exhibit 100, this is the summary that we did of various people's personnel records. And it's our page 38. This is Marianne Cortullo. Let's go up and just blow up the part there about her pay. Marianne Cortullo testified. Remember, she told you she loves Senator Fumo. She's devoted to him. And it's not hard to see why. In 2000, she was being paid $32,000 a year. And her salary went up by just 60% just in a six-year period to where she's earning $51,000 a year for legislative support LS1, which is someone who writes legislation, basically, which is not what she was doing in the basement on Tasker Street. Roseanne Pacello is even more amazing. Page 33 of our document, this is just astonishing. She, even if she's doing constituent service, her pay goes up to, by the end of our period here, she is earning over $113,000 a year. That's about four times what the average constituent service person is making, if that's really her job. I mean, this is just outright theft. What this is Roseanne Pacello is, as Mr. Fumo told you, his sister. She's like a sister to him. They've been friends forever, and this is what you get for being a friend of Senator Fumo. You get $113,000 a year. Now, the way you get it is it's not, as they tried to tell us, well, there are no rules. I can just pay people whatever I want to pay people. The way you get it is you have to classify them. Those are the rules of the Senate. And since there's nothing that she's doing that justifies $113,000 a year under the pay plans of the Senate, you have to lie. And that's why we're here, and that's why this case is about mail fraud and wire fraud. They tried to tell us throughout the trial from the defense side, and then when Mr. Dugalecki and Mr. Fumo testified, that there are no rules, that all the rules that the Senate has come up with don't apply to Mr. Fumo's staff. No, they're unique. They've been there for a while. They do jobs and budget analysis and things like that, and they cannot be treated the way other Senate employees are treated. They told us that these plans are advisory, as if the Senate spent hundreds of thousands of dollars to write these pay plans. The first one, the job classification and pay plan, I'm holding Exhibit 101. The second, done by that thing called the Hay Group, that's Exhibit 102. I guess that they did these pay plans for fun, because they just wanted to see what a pay plan would look like. And then you saw on cross-examination of Mr. Dugalecki and Mr. Fumo how it all just unraveled, because you saw Mr. Fumo, when he testified, and he was testifying about the old pay plan, and trying to explain how is it that these people could be classified the way you see and getting the salaries that they got. He said things on direct like, quote, the old plan was not descriptive of anything we did in the Senate. Quote, no one really cared about it. I never read it. I never seen it. I never cared about it. He said when he figured out what he wanted to pay people, he sent it to Dugalecki, who, quote, did whatever he did, and I did not know or care, end quote. I did not know what the classifications were, because there really weren't classifications that were appropriate. And then, on cross, it all fell apart, because he was shown the minutes of the COMO meetings, the Committee on Management Operations, that he attended. And you saw that he cared an awful lot about these classifications, because you had to. That's how people were paid within the Senate. And you saw example after example, if you want to look at it again, it's Government Exhibit 1804, where Mr. Fumo attended these meetings and asked and worked with the classifications. asked for exceptions, asked for people to be paid above the playpen, asked for classifications to be changed, for new classifications to be created. And why? They told us it was not the law, that this was never adopted. And then we see it is the law of the Senate, that every 2 years on the first day of the session, they pass what they call the financial operating rules, which say the employee files have to have accurate information about what employees do. And for classifications to be changed, it requires the approval of COMO. And so it turns out it's there in the law all along. And then the cross-examine on cross, it changes. It's no longer, I don't care about it. It's, well, we have to work within COMO. Mr. Fumo said, if you can't find any other way to do it, you go to COMO. COMO is the last resort, he now says. He says you have to provide some justification providing the salary in that range if you can't find one, you go to COMO. Completely different testimony from direct examination to cross-examination. Because the fact of the matter is, these are the rules that were followed. Mr. Faber told that to you explicitly. They came and went after him on this being advisory, and he said no. He said, these are the plans that he follows. And if people send him false information and he finds out, it's not going to fly. And if people tell him correct information, he's going to put people and review it to see if they go in the classifications they belong. And then it goes to COMO if you want to be reclassified. And COMO, you learned, is no slouch committee. These are the leaders of the Senate, the majority leader, the minority leader, the whips, Senator Fumo, the Appropriations Committee chairman, their top staff. These are people you heard about throughout the trial on this committee. Mello, Jubilier, Lepore, Dugalecki. These are the top people in the Senate deciding what is the fair and right way to pay their employees. But Dugalecki and Fumo simply don't care. Mr. Fumo wants to pay people whatever he wants to pay people. And Mr. Dugalecki, as part of this conspiracy, is willing to go along and write whatever he needs to write, no matter how absurd it may be, in order to get the pay done the way they want it to be done. Mr. Dugalecki tried the same thing on direct. He said, well, you know, it's no big deal, and then admitted on cross. He said, I have to make it acceptable to the chief clerk. And that was his words to explain why he wrote what he wrote. And by the way, even though this is part of the law and policy of the Senate, I just have to say that you listened to His Honor's instructions this morning about mail and wire fraud. There's no requirement that there be a law before you can be found guilty of lying to somebody. Fraud is where you deceive someone in order to get an advantage over somebody and get something that you don't think you're otherwise going to get. It's not in the law. It was not in the instructions. That it needs to be something that somebody's written a law that you can't get. I mean, this happens to be the Senate of Pennsylvania. But take any business. Say you have a business where an executive gets the memo from on high that says, pay your secretary $40,000 a year. And the executive wants the secretary to do some personal business work for him after hours and wants to pay her $60,000 of the company's money. And so he sends up a false memo to management that says, well, she's not a secretary. She's actually, you know, some other junior executive, and makes a false statement so she gets $60,000. That's a fraud. It doesn't matter that that company's pay plan has not been adopted as a resolution by the Senate of Pennsylvania. I mean, this is kind of a crazy argument that's being presented to you. But as it turns out, doesn't matter because this is their policy. They did pass this as a resolution. The classifications are the key. You have to work within these classifications. And if you want to change someone's classification, even under the new plan, that requires the approval of COMO. And what Mr. Fumo did and what Mr. Dugalecki did is they wrote around it. And you know that just from looking at the many forms that we've shown you. Why did Mr. Dugalecki write on these forms that Roseanne Pacello writes legislation? Why did he write that Marianne Cortullo does legislative research, that Jamie Spagna researches policy, that Charlie Shoulders writes budget reports, that David Nelson, you saw, does the liaison with city officials? These are all false statements. And every witness who was on the stand, whether it was Cozzo or Spagna or Cortullo or Novelli, everyone we showed the forms to, Shoulders, every single one of them said, that's not my job. I don't do that. Why were they lying? The only reason, the only explanation is, if you tell the truth, you're not getting what you want. And they knew that. They couldn't write down, well, Charlie Shoulders is a great guy. He stands in line at PennDOT. He drives me around when I'm in town. But I want to pay him like he's the top administrative officer in the Senate. You can't say Roseanne Pacello meets with ward leaders all day and does whatever constituent needs they have, and let's pay her as a chief of staff $113,000 a year, even though we have another chief of staff, Charlie Hoffman, one floor above her, who's getting paid in that range. If you say those things, you're not going to get it, and that's why we clearly have a fraud. I'll use Mr. Kogan's definition from his opening statement. He said, quote, nothing is done secretly, nothing is done through misrepresentation. You're going to hear, nothing is done in a clandestine fashion because that's the essence of a fraud. He's right. That is the essence of a fraud. And that's what you see here when you go through these pay records over and over and over again. Defense Exhibit 513 was the email that Roseanne Pacello sends to the staff saying, from orders of your direct supervisor, meaning Mr. Fumo, you do not have to answer the survey being sent out by the Hay Group, where the Hay Group is working to figure out what do people do in the Senate so they can develop this new, trying to have a rational pay plan. Why don't they want them to answer the survey? What don't they want them to know about what people are doing in the Senate office? The rules, as always, do not apply to the Fumo office, and that's what you see here. Now, I want to show you and explain. This will take a bit. I want to explain. Exhibit 144. This exhibit is not in evidence. You haven't seen this before, and I'm using this as a demonstration right now, and so I'm not that good at writing on the board, so we've typed it out here, and I'm going to talk about that as we go through it. What we've outlined here is we've put numbers on this fraud, this part of the scheme involving the overpayment, by looking at where should these people have been classified. Because what's really interesting, when Mr. Fumo testified, and he talked about this pay plan, when he was disparaging it on direct examination and saying it doesn't apply to us, he said it doesn't even cover budget analysts. Can you believe that in the Senate? And, of course, there are five budget analyst categories in it. In fact, he said this must have been written for some other organization and we adopted it. Well, if you want to take the time during your deliberations, take Exhibit 101, read through it, and you'll see every page is written for the Senate of Pennsylvania. And it describes every logical job you would expect to find in a legislature. And so we read through it, and we looked for, comparing to the evidence, where would these people be classified? So, for example, Ruth Arnail. Now, we have no evidence, really, that she did any Senate work at all, as I talked about before. But the statement was, oh, she does constituent service. Well, there's a thing called field representative. And let's just look at that one description. I'm not going to take your time with all of these because you can do it. But I just want to point this out. If we go to Exhibit 101, which is the book I'm holding, and go to page 147, R147, this is field representative. And again, you'll see how this is written precisely for a legislative office. What this is this is the top constituent service position you could get under the old plan that describes the things that we heard were going on Tasker Street. There may be other categories that you can put people in, but look what it says here. Supervises and coordinates the operations in the district office, including scheduling the senator's activities, performing tasks, reviewing important correspondence. Act as the senator's principal representative by responding to significant, complex constituent inquiries and problems. Maintain contact between the senator and other elected officials. Serve as the principal liaison between the district and the senator. This is a high-level district office position, obviously written precisely for the district office, but it's pay range 6. And if you go to the chart that's at the beginning of this book, the pay ranges go up to 18. The leaders of the Senate decided that this job would be paid in the $30,000 to $40,000 range. That was their decision. That decision didn't sit with Senator Fumo. He wants to pay people more. So Ruth Arnail, even if she was doing the job, that's why if we go back to Exhibit 144, we looked at what's the high end of the range, what's the most that job could be paid, assuming they put her at the high end of the range. Either that or go to Como and get them, like he did with so many other people, and get approval above the range or reclassification. The amount is $34,000. By the time you get to 2003, which is her last full year in the Senate, now we're working here off of the pay stubs that are, we have a separate exhibit for each employee, you can look them up, that has their W-2s and you can see where we get these numbers from. By she's getting paid $54,000 more than the top of that range. This is why we're here, ladies and gentlemen. This is not no de minimis case, as somebody might say. For Ruth Arnao alone, if she were paid at the top level consistently as a field representative, this is $250,000 that she has overpaid. Now, why is that? Why? Because she's willing to do whatever Senator Fumo wants her to do whenever he wants her to do it. And when you go through this chart, you will see that for everybody else that we looked at. If we scroll down, the next person on the chart here, Lillian Cozzo. Paul Dugalecki, this applies, we'll get later, to Sue Scott-Nicky as well. Mr. Dugalecki admitted on the stand that if you read the description for Executive Secretary 2, which is in that book, it's a perfect description of your top-level, reliable executive secretary that a senator needs. Someone who supervises others, someone who does some of the management in the office, as well as the secretarial work. If you want someone with just secretarial work, they had Executive Secretary 1. So if you look at Executive Secretary 2, you see that it wasn't good enough. They moved her up. That's what we've used. We've put here what it would be. She was actually classified, and you can look at the exhibits that say this. She was put in as Executive Assistant 4, and then it moved up, I believe. Let me find in my notes here. Executive Assistant 4, and then Legislative Support LS3, which means under the new plan, that's one of the top levels for high-level legislation that somebody is developing. It's completely false. But the reason they're doing it is because if you pay her as Executive Secretary 2, the highest you get under the old plan is $46,300. Administrative A5 that we wrote down here for 04 and 05, that's the very top administrative level under the new plan, which has broader categories. But even that only goes up to $50,000. They moved her into these other things, Executive Assistant 4, Legislative Support, LS3, simply to pay her more. Mr. Dugalecki admitted, Executive Secretary described what she did, but he said Senator Fumo wanted to pay her more. And he was willing to conspire with Mr. Fumo to make that happen. And there you see the overpayment involving Ms. Cozzo. A quick thing about Executive Assistant 4 that's pretty interesting is that if you look at the description for Executive Assistant 4 that's in the book, and I won't take the time to pull all this up on the screen, but the reason it's high level and the reason it pays a lot more than what they would have gotten is it says it's the primary office administrator. This is the person who's in charge of the office. And it's interesting because there's a point in time at which Tasker Street, which only has at any given time between 10 and 15 employees, there's one point where Tasker Street has 4 primary office administrators, Cozzo, Arnao, Pacello, and Hoffman. And that's because they're just bumping them all up in order to give away money, which is what this is. Go to Lou Leonetti. Now, again, as I said before, we don't know anything, but we find the description of legislative clerk messenger, which if you read it in the book, is a pretty good description of somebody who runs errands and does other tasks around the office and can be relied on to go places. But it only pays $23,000 a year. We moved him up in our classification to administrative A4 under the new plan because we're trying to give the benefit of the doubt. That's the highest administrative level one can get without supervising others, and he obviously did not supervise others. Now, are we right about all this? Well, we're probably being overgenerous. Because we're trying to give the benefit of the doubt and going to the highest level that's justified and the highest part on these pay ranges. And even then, we can't come close, except in the last 2 years here for Leonetti, where he actually gets less than administrative A4. And it's rare, you'll see as we go through this chart. We can't get anywhere near what Dugalecki does. And the reason we can't is because he's putting in false statements saying that they're doing other, more high-level jobs that they're not doing. Go to the next page. Dave Nelson, same thing. We suggest classification of him in the same places because he's doing the same job as Leonetti. But he got paid more than Leonetti. He was around longer, and they simply wanted him to be paid more. That's one of the justifications that Mr. Fumo gets. He said, "Well, you don't understand. My people have been here for a long time." Well, that's the reason that you have these ranges. If you look at the book. For example, we said $34,000 for a field representative. That starts out down in the 20s somewhere, and it's assumed that you're going to move up within the grades in that pay range as you spend more time. If you max out on the grade, you heard from all the witnesses. You go to COMO. They have this set up in a very rational way. And are we supposed to believe that There's no one else in the Senate of Pennsylvania who's been there for 10 years or 15 years or 20 years? Of course not. The only difference is they're following the rules. And in this office, they're giving away money to the people who are personally serving Senator Fumo. So he gets significantly overpaid because Nelson, and we pointed this out when we went through his testimony, Nelson moves up to administrative officer four, and then he's not put in the administrative category under the new plan. That's what he is. He's an office worker, and that's where they have all the administrative people. But it's not enough money. It tops out at about $50,000 a year. So they move him to constituent relations four, as if he's one of the top-level constituent relations people in the Senate for driving Senator Fumo around, and thus they can get him up towards $60,000 a year for the work that he's doing. Let's keep going. Roseanne Pichella, we've already talked about. Just enormous overpayment to her above the job that she's doing. We same field representative thing would obviously apply to her, or a constituent relations position. We say here, if you assume that these constituent relations CR5, that's the highest level for constituent relations under the new plan, and she's still overpaid by $30,000 each year. Why? Because Senator Fumo wants her to have it, and she's doing his taxes, and she's in business with him, and they're doing everything else together. Marianne Cortula, same thing. Very generous to call her a field representative because she doesn't supervise anyone. Constituent relations CR2, that's the highest level you can get if you're doing constituent relations without supervising somebody. And she's an aide to Ms. Pichella, and so you can see the overpayment there. Charlie Shoulders, big, big overpayment. Even if you put him in clerk 2, which is a higher level clerk position, administrative A4, again, these are the levels for what he's doing right below where you start supervising other people. And if you put him at those highest levels, you can't get up to what they're paying him by calling him administrative officers and constituent relations and the other things that they do for him. In fact, let's just break from this for 1 second. Let's look at Exhibit 413, page 10. This is from Shoulder's personnel file. And you see here that what Fumo and Dugalecki wanted to do in September of 2005, even at that late date, is pay them more. And so Susan Scott-Nicky, who's an executive secretary, Ms. Kozo, it says here that she assists the senator, chief of staff, and members of the caucus in the development of fiscal policies for the caucus with regard to implementation of certain elements of the state budget. She advises directly on how certain appropriations should be allocated in keeping with the interests of the chairman and members of the caucus. This is fiction writing, is what it is. And all we heard about Ms. Scott-Nicky is that besides being the secretary, she handles those DCED grants. When the senator decides who's going to get that WHAM money, she fills out the form. And they write here, oh, no, she's advising and assisting the senator and the caucus on the development of fiscal policies. It's just an outrageous fraud. Ms. Scott-Nicky, by the time she leaves the Senate, like Roseanne Pichella, is being paid more than $100,000 a year, more than double any other experienced secretary probably in the Senate, assuming that every secretary is being capped out at the top of the administrative level, as the Hay Group intended and as Como has enforced it and Mr. Faber has enforced it. Charlie Shoulders, what happened with Charlie Shoulders? Well, when they first did the Hay Group plan, you'll see this in his personnel file, they had him at the top administrative level, A5. The man who Paul Dugalecki says can't put two logs together on a farm has the highest administrative position that says that you're supervising others and doing the most complex administrative tasks in running a Senate office. But that's not good enough. Because if you look at the beginning of the book for the Hay Plan, where they show you what the salaries are, they have a range that each of these different categories gets paid. And I'll hold that up to you. So you've got the administrative group, the constituent relations group, legislative support, professional managerial, policy development, all the way up to chief of staff. And what they do is they have these colored ranges, and you can see how the salaries go up for these different levels. So the problem there, now it's all very sensible, very rational. This is what the Senate and Como wants to do, but Mr. Fumo wants different rules. So you see that the administrative level here at the bottom caps out at a little over $50,000. And so when Mr. Shoulders gets there, his job hasn't changed at all. He's driving Senator Fumo around. He's waiting in line at PennDOT. it's not enough. So now he's got to become constituent relations 4, which is what you see here, because that little blue bar gets you above the $50,000 range on the administrative table, and now he can get paid more money. But to do that, you have to lie. And that's why it says he assists the senator and chief of staff by responding to complex constituent inquiries and requests for assistance, something that even he told you is a complete fiction. I'm going to look at my notes here real briefly because I went through this pretty quickly, and I don't want to test your patience going back and forth, but it's something you can do. Looking at the different pay plans, you'll see how carefully they're written out for the Senate. Look at the pay ranges that are at the beginning of each book, and then look at what these people were paid, and look at what Mr. Dugalecki had to write in order to get them paid. Now, on our list there, there are 8 employees that we listed. And let's go back to Exhibit 144 if we could. Let's look at the last page. After shoulders, you have Ms. Skatnicki, and you can see these very substantial overpayments. I told you that she's getting $83,000 a year by the time our chart ends in 2005, meaning even if she were at the top of the administrative level, she gets another $33,000 on top of that because of this nonsense about her advising on fiscal policy or what have you. The total for these 8 employees that we come up to, and we think it's a conservative total, is about $1 million in overpayments during this period of time. What are these people being paid for? Skatnicki is being paid because she's handling the farm work. Shoulders is doing that and doing the shopping and everything else that he does for him. Cortullo and Pacello and Arneo and all the other people I've talked about. That's the fraud here. That's what's so substantial. This is what they would like you to think is spitting on the sidewalk, which obviously it is not. Now, this chart does not include 2 people who are part of this group of the dedicated people who are serving Senator Fumo and doing what needs to be done. Those 2 people are Jamie Spagna and Gina Novelli. And the reason that we have not included them is because, and you'll see we have a final chart later on that adds all of this up, is because I've already argued to you that all of their pay is for non-Senate work. That it's very simple to calculate in their case. Jamie Spagna eventually earns more than $40,000 a year. She's not doing anything for the Senate for those years in question. But if you looked at the items, we looked at them with Ms. Novelli and Ms. Spagna, and they are the descriptions that were submitted, and they testified to it, are as false as any others that you've looked at. Let's look quickly at Exhibit 104, which is the Jamie Spagna's personnel file, and go to page 3. This was done in 2001. And in order to classify her as a legislative assistant, it says that she met with constituents, attended meetings with the senator, prepared correspondence, researched potential legislation. She testified to you in 2001. She did none of that. There did come a time later on when they changed everything in 2004, when she got $1,000 a month to go do the political work at home, that she did start to do some of those things at the office. But that was not her job in 2001. That, once again, is a complete fiction. But the fraud there, of course, is that everything she's getting paid is for doing non-Senate work. One of the last things I'm going to say before we talk about the Senate contractors involves the equipment, just to wrap that up. I mean, there you have a clear theft from the Senate and really no explanation. There, once again, Senator Fumo just says, well, it was wrong to give Dottie a computer, as if we're supposed to say, well, okay, you gave away a $2,500 laptop computer, and everything is okay, it's no big deal. But of course, all of this is a big deal. He was the one in charge of this. Exhibit 794 was Luchko's email, where Mr. Luchko says the rules that he follows. He's the gatekeeper, he's the guy giving out the equipment, and he, remember how Governor Rendell said the rules are the rules, where these are Mr. Luchko's rules, which are that if I have something handy and get it, I'll get it. However, for something special, like a laptop or a PC or wireless networking, they must make their request through the senator, and he must okay it. And what did he okay? He okayed a Senate equipment for his wife until she was no longer his wife, for his daughter, for his girlfriend Dottie, for the butler, for Ms. Arneo's daughter, Missy. You remember Exhibit 808? Mr. Fumo tried to say that the 2 stepsons, Ms. Arneo's 2 stepsons, Chad and Blake, had laptops to use in college, courtesy of the Senate of Pennsylvania. And Mr. Fumo testified to you and said, oh, well, I think they were doing something for us once, and so we let them have a laptop. You can decide whether you believe that, because you can look at this email where Lechko's trying to get it back and says, Chris Klemmer, remember that was Podgorski's predecessor, loaned out to Chad for school, seeing how he just graduated, and if he's not using it anymore, can I get that back as well? Obviously, no one's doing anything for the Senate. These laptops are being passed out like they're door prizes to the people who are the friends and family of Senator Fumo, and it's just consistent with everything else in this case. You don't have to look at the evidence in isolation. Your job, you're allowed to look at all of the evidence to see how it fits, and you get a very clear picture of what these people did with the resources that were available to them. Ms. Arnao herself, after she left the Senate at the beginning of 2004, had three computers. Remember, Lechko wrote to her about them. One in her home in Philadelphia, one at the shore, and one down at her condominium in Florida because she was in the inner circle. David Nelson had a computer at home. His kids would use it for homework. Remember that friend of Mr. Fumo's son wanted to use a computer, and they set him up with that until they found out that he was a spammer. It was just anything goes. Now, he knew the rules. If you look at Exhibit 797, this was where one of the times that Mr. Fumo broke up with Ms. Agri in June of 2002. And one of the things he says is, return all of the computer equipment that I lent you. And her testimony was interesting. She said, he didn't lend it to me. He gave it to me. Now that we're breaking up, it's a loan, and she had to give it back after she had used it for several years and give back whatever productive life that it had left. Really interesting is Exhibit 804. Christian Marone was a little late in returning his Senate laptop. Now, he was on the outs at this point when he left his Senate employment. And so this is what Mr. Fumo wrote about him. Send out the effing state police to his office in the DA's office in Montgomery County to get the laptop back. Now, suddenly, it's stolen equipment for a non-Senate employee to have a Senate computer, which is what he's been doing all along. Everything starts to change. Ms. Agri testified to you that Allie couldn't have her computer anymore. They had to give back her Senate computer, and Mr. Lechko was assigned the task as part of his job of buying her a new one. Now, we heard all sorts of explanations from this. Mr. Fumo testified in his direct examination that, well, he got computers at his home because he tested them for the caucus, for the Democratic caucus. And now we're being told that 2220 Green Street is a research and development laboratory for the Senate of Pennsylvania to test out computers. This for an organization that uses computers to do word processing and spreadsheets. Nobody's doing anything sophisticated here. This is not Microsoft or Google. He's not sitting testing computers all day or using Allie to do it. And in fact, the same thing he said about the butler, Mr. Fonseca. Oh, it's okay, he had a computer, there was just one laying around in my house, so he used it. Not true. I told you, I'll show you the times that the testimony is clearly not true. If you look at Exhibit 814 and 815, there are emails with Mr. Lechko and Mr. Wilson where they're setting up the laptop and the equipment that Fonseca needs in the house that was not there. Why? Because he now works for Senator Fumo, so he gets free Senate equipment. Or if you look at Exhibit 824, this is in August, they think that he's going to leave. He actually sticks around for another 6 months. But there's a time where he might have been leaving. And so Lechko writes, sorry you're leaving. If next Thursday is your last day, then I want to get the laptop back no later than next Thursday. This was a laptop that they got from the stock in Harrisburg so that the senator's assistant, or whatever you want to call him, could have a computer. It was true of everything. Blackberries, email addresses, all of these people who did not work for the Senate, if they were within his favor, got anything that they needed. Okay, the last set of topics, I believe, regarding this fraud on the Senate concerns the contractors who work for the Senate. And they fall into two categories. You've got the contractors Rubin and Palermo who do nothing, who are friends of Senator Fumo, which entitles them to tens of thousands of dollars a year for nothing. These are no-show jobs, as clear a fraud as you could have. And then you've got the group that's doing political and personal work. You've got Wallace and Kane and Phil Press, who themselves are getting hundreds of thousands of dollars, really for the same reason as all these employees that I've been talking about all afternoon, because they're willing to help out Senator Fumo in the ways he wants, as this spectacular scheme just goes on and on. Mitch Rubin, he gets a contract, a Exhibit 520. Now, the first interesting thing about this is the contract's not with him. The contract is with B&R Services. Now, the Senate has nothing to do with B&R Services. B&R Services does court reporting and depositions and filings and finding things in court. The Senate has no need for any service of B&R Services. So the first question you got to ask is, why is the contract with them? We know that Mr. Rubin is an entrepreneur. He has many different entities. You heard he even had a business relationship with Senator Fumo himself. He started a gambling venture. He had an investigation firm. Certainly, he can go create something called Mitchell Rubin Consulting, which would tell everybody very clearly what it is that's supposedly happening here. Even Phil Press knew how to create Phil Press Associates. But no, they do this with B&R Services. It's really the first part of the cover-up. And it's to pay $30,000 a year, supposedly, for research, analysis, and making recommendations on legislative matters and assist in constituent service. But he does nothing. How do you prove a negative? How do you prove that, which is often our task in this case? How do you prove that somebody did nothing? Well, you ask everybody you can ask. And so we ask witness after witness in the Tasker Street office whether they're friendly to the government or hostile or, best of all, just completely unbiased and right down the middle. And not a single one knew anything about anything that Mitchell Rubin did. We asked Lillian Cozzo, the main coordinator for Mr. Fumo and his office. She had no idea Mr. Rubin had a Senate contract or did anything for the Senate. Jamie Spagna, who handled all the finances. Marianne Cortullo, who was there full-time in the basement. Don Wilson, who handled the computers. Howard Kane, who ran the campaigns. He knew about Mitchell Rubin. He said Mr. Rubin's a big fundraiser for Senator Fumo and attended all the political meetings that we had in the Senate office. And you start to get the idea of why it is that Mr. Fumo is showering this largesse on Mitchell Rubin. Frank Wallace, who did investigations. Trisha Kirby, who worked upstairs in the Pitts office. In Harrisburg, we asked anybody who testified. Sura, Shoulders, Rossi. None of them know anything about Mr. Rubin. And importantly, we asked Dottie Eggery about it. Now, we got criticized a little bit in questions that were asked during the trial, saying, you're asking the wrong people. I'm not quite sure who we would ask other than this long list. Dottie Eggery, she doesn't work with Mitchell Rubin. But think about it. She socializes with Mr. Rubin and Ms. Arnao and Mr. Fumo constantly, weekly, at the shore, in Florida, in Martha's Vineyard. When you socialize with someone and they're among your close circle of friends, you know what they do. You may not be able to say with detail what they do every hour from 9 to 5, but if my friend is a lawyer, odds are I know he's a lawyer, or if someone is an accountant, I know she's an accountant. When, you know, I asked Dottie Eggery, we were going through a number of people, and I asked her about Gene Bender. We were talking about a subject, and she said, oh, Gene Bender. She had a computer contract with the Senate to provide computer services. Well, of course, if you know these people and socialize with these people, you know the basics of what they do. She had no idea that Mitch Rubin ever had a contract. In fact, she remembered some details. She remembered that Mitchell Rubin and Vince Fumo talked about other business deals. She remembered they talked about getting into some ATM business on the turnpike and something about monitoring, electronic monitoring for people on bail in the city of Philadelphia. She had a great memory, great recall. And she remembered the things that people talked about. Never a mention that Mitchell Rubin was a contractor or did any of the things that Mr. Fumo said. Even Paul Dugalecki, who generally is willing to defend just about anything, said he didn't know what Mr. Rubin did. He signed the contracts and he assumed that the work was taking place. Another interesting point was that, and by the way, everything I just said, that whole group of people I just listed, we asked the same people about Michael Palermo. So when I get to Mr. Palermo, this is the next topic, I'll save myself some time. I'm not going to read that list again. Every single one of those people knew nothing about Mike Palermo, other than Dugalecki, who we'll talk about. That's what was going on here. And Palermo and Rubin are also interesting in that they're among the only people who did not get laptop computers from the Senate and did not have email addresses on Fumo.com. And when you think about that, that's kind of interesting. The butler had a laptop. The girlfriend had a laptop and a Fumo.com address. The daughter had a laptop. Rubin and Palermo, supposedly the people who are indispensable in consulting with Senator Fumo, don't have the basic means of communicating with Senator Fumo. I mean, that also obviously tells you a lot. So what did – we went through this. I think we proved very clearly that Mitchell Rubin did nothing. We subpoenaed the Senate and said, give us anything that refers to work done by Mitchell Rubin. There is nothing, not one scrap of paper. We did the same thing with BNR Services. Give us anything. There is nothing. Now, again, this is the important point I was talking about before with Christian Marone. Christian Marone, they've got those 15 memos that talk about work for the police. It may not be much, but they did the best they could. They saved everything that they could put their hands on. By the beginning of 2004, they know this investigation is underway. Rubin and Palermo remain on Senate contracts until the middle of 2004 when they get cut off because they just obviously can't be justified. And it's one of the many things that changes at that moment. But you know from everything you've seen in this case that if there were a piece of paper that Rubin or Palermo touched during those final 6 months of the contract, they would have kept it. You know from everything you've seen from the defense side that if one of those men was in the office one day and ate a candy bar, they would have kept the wrapper. But you have nothing, zero. And that, of course, tells you what you need to know. There was no work that was done. All right, that's our case. And the defense presents its case. And as I said before, they have no burden of proof. But you're allowed to evaluate, am I convinced by what they told me? Mr. Jacobs said in his opening statement, quote, about Mitchell Rubin, you're going to see that he did tons of work. And if anything, was underpaid, end quote. That's what he said. You can evaluate that for yourself. They called three witnesses before they called Senator Fumo about Mitchell Rubin. They called David Urban, who at one time was the chief of staff for Senator Specter in Washington. And Mr. Urban told you that he had one meeting that was attended by Mitchell Rubin for 1 hour in Washington, D.C., back around 2000, that was about Jefferson Square. And other than that, he knows nothing about any connection with Jefferson Square that Mr. Rubin had. The meeting went nowhere. That didn't result in any funding. And that was it. He didn't know if Mr. Rubin was in town for something else that day and came with his friends from Jefferson Square. That's all he knows. Witness number two was James White, a lawyer from Harrisburg. Mr. White called Rubin, not the other way around, and called him and said after the contract ended in late 2004 or early 2005, because he knew that Rubin was someone familiar with the court system. That's his business, BNR Services, doing court filing. And he wanted to find out what the sheriff's position was regarding a mortgage foreclosure issue. So he reached out for Rubin to ask him that question. That's it, after the contract took place. Witness number three was the most amazing, was Jeffrey Suzensky. Mr. Suzensky was a part-time lobbyist from the Stevens and Lee law firm in Harrisburg. And he told you that there were times that he would run into Mr. Rubin in the state capitol, and they would have a Coke together, and they would talk about issues that Mr. Suzensky thought were of interest to Senator Fumo, such as Independence Blue Cross, which Senator Fumo was very interested in. He was on the board. He was getting a lot of business at Dilworth from it. And so based on that, Mr. Suzensky concluded that Mr. Rubin must be some kind of advisor to Senator Fumo. Then Senator Fumo testifies, and he says, this is my main guy. He is my liaison. And he starts listing off all of these important people and these important institutions, CHOP, Drexel, McKee Rehabilitation. He names names of lawyers in town, aides to mayors, Congressman Brady. He has this long list of people that he relies on for Mr. Rubin to communicate with. What is that? That they say that this is what Mr. Rubin did for his contract, and the witness they produce is a part-time lobbyist who runs into Mr. Rubin in the hallway in the Capitol and has a Coke with him? I mean, you probably wouldn't have believed this if I just told you about it and you hadn't seen it yourself. What obviously happened here was that, I mean, if he met with all these people and did all of these things, they could call them as witnesses. Those people could have been calling us for years to tell us, you know, you people are out of your mind. What are you alleging that Mitchell Rubin doesn't do anything for the Senate? And of course, we'd evaluate it. They call Jeffrey Suzensky, the part-time lobbyist. Obviously, what happened is they're racking their minds for any time Mitchell Rubin had a conversation with anybody about something that might relate to an issue of the Senate before the Senate, and they called him as a witness. I mean, this is obviously the clearest part of the case. The witnesses we called knew exactly what was going on. They never saw him do anything relating to the Senate. They never heard of him. There's no paper that says it. There's no document that says it. And what about Mitchell Rubin himself? He was in the courtroom every day. And you're allowed to ask yourself, again, nope, it's not their burden, but you can ask yourself in deciding whether you believe the defense testimony that you heard, what's he doing over there? Why isn't he on the witness stand saying what his friend Vince Fumo just said? I mean, it's devastating, obviously, that you did not hear truthful testimony from Mr. Fumo. Again, I don't take any pleasure in saying it, but it's a fact. Mitchell Rubin did nothing. He got $30,000 a year from the taxpayers of Pennsylvania, $150,000 over 5 years, because he was a friend of Senator Fumo, and because he supported him in his campaigns, because he traveled with him, because he socialized with him. Adding to the many hundreds of thousands of dollars of fraud that I've already talked about, and more I'll talk about tomorrow. I really have to thank you for all your patience in listening to me for so long. You can tell, as I said, there's just a great deal of evidence here, and I appreciate very much your giving me the opportunity to summarize it. I'm almost done with the Senate fraud of the case. The Citizens Alliance part is very substantial also, as you know. I then hope to move a lot more quickly in talking about the Seaport Museum and the obstruction of justice. They are important, but they involve, you know, fewer stories and less evidence. I desperately hope to finish before tomorrow and let my colleagues on the other side take it over. But thank you so much for all of your attention.
All right, members, it's your 10 o'clock. Hey, Matt. We'll meet at 10. We'll resume tomorrow at 10:30.
10:30?
Yeah. As the one juror has a doctor's appointment.
10:30.
Start 10:30. Judge, I'm going to have various objections to various comments that Mr. Zosmer made. Do you want me to do that now, or do you want to wait until tomorrow morning to do that before we start, or what?
Let's do it tomorrow morning.
Yeah, I'll go through my notes. I've got quite a list, and I didn't want to interrupt him during his speech because of the way that's reflected on the defense when you do that. But he has said a lot of things that I suggest are prohibited, including people would have been calling us up over the years. I don't know what they've been doing over the years. He's testifying repeatedly about things outside the courtroom that never came up. And I'll give you a lot of examples of that. And I'm going to ask you to admonish him to watch what he says if you caught any of these things yourself.
Well, why don't we meet here tomorrow? Okay. Since we, Mr. Hogan, before you leave. And we'll be here tomorrow as scheduled at 10 o'clock, and you can raise those objections.
Happy to. Thank you.
Okay? And Mr. Zosmer, you may at that time respond.
Thank you, sir.
Court is adjourned.
Have a good evening. Thank you.